you know, it compromised confidentiality. You know, it wasn't secure.
That was true until about 2 weeks ago, and then they did another patch today, which further locked it down. There was a hole in the security in Zoom, and they found it and they plugged it, which is why now you guys are seeing passwords. You cannot get into Zoom without passwords. I have things I have to do on the back end from a security standpoint as a host now.
Okay.
So it's a little bit more secure.
So I guess if you wanted to send them a link and a password, I guess. Yeah.
Oh, okay. And to start that, I'd have to go on what, zoom.com and get all set up?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you just type in Zoom and it'll download for free.
No, last night, I was with Equilibrium on a Zoom, and when I signed off, it automatically updated for, took about 5 minutes before they finally let me go.
Yeah, they rolled the patch yesterday.
I think it's going to do that to mine today, too, I think, probably, my system. So
I didn't do anything. I just let the computer buzz away for about 5 minutes, and then it says I'm ready to go bye-bye.
Okay.
Right.
But it's just free for 40 minutes or so, right?
Well, that's a different issue. That's if you don't pay for the service.
Right.
Yeah, I guess
and
if you're free,
then it's
limited.
Compliant.
That could be a problem, I guess.
It depends. So if it's up to 40 minutes, if there's more than two people on, if it's only two people, then it's unlimited time.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks, Michael.
You're welcome.
Good to know.
And Carrie, I don't know if the bugs that they fixed, if it took care of the HIPAA part of it. I know that they locked down Zoom so that the problem was you could see if you were a hacker, you could actually hack in there, take control of a Zoom meeting and see the names and information that was being presented on a screen. That is what they locked down that you cannot do. I don't know whether that now meets HIPAA compliance. I haven't looked into that. But they did lock it down quite a bit.
And to get HIPAA compliance, one part of that is a BAA agreement, and that's only in a paid subscription with Zoom.
Right. Now, that's true. And we have a paid subscription. Yeah, what you guys are on is a paid subscription.
Hola.
And what?
Sorry.
What does a paid prescription cost?
It depends. I think it's $200 a month. If you're just buying it straight out,
I've signed up. There is a
$14.99
a month, and then a $19.99 a month.
Right.
And then if you pay for the whole year, then it's that one fee, Carrie, that you had mentioned. You know, it'll come out to like they'll give you a discount, and it'll come out to like either 120 or 150 or something. Like that. Depends on how many people you want to have access to your Zoom account. So if it's just one person, then you could do one level. But if you need multiple people, then you need to go up to the higher levels.
Okay.
We may have to have a Zoom tutorial. Long distance.
In fact, they have a tutorial on Zoom. If you go there on the top right-hand corner, there's a little tutorial for 30 minutes, and it tells you all about it.
Well, there you go. We have options about that. All right. Any questions anybody has as we're starting today? Welcome, everyone. I see some names. I see some faces. Sometimes you're just a name.
When you do the session on the phone, are you letting the clients sit down or lay down? Or how would you do that?
I prefer they just be in a quiet place where they won't. I ask that they be in a quiet place where they won't be interrupted. I did have one client that was kind of freaking out and having an anxiety or some kind of nausea reaction. And asked if she could lie down. I said, sure, you take your phone with you. So she lay down, did the thing with the phone lying down. But most of the time, people are just sitting up like you would for a normal session. Sort of off the record, I guess, but it's going to be recorded anyway. I am scanning clients and seeing that the accuracy is pretty good. So I holographically picture them in front of me and go ahead and scan, start at the back. Actually, I think I'm getting more data long distance than I get when I'm in person sometimes. The physical body can be a visual distraction. that you can holographically picture them in front of you and see if you confirm data. The first client I ever did a phone session with, I had two nausea sites. When I scanned them, I got nauseated in two places and confirmed two concussions that they had had. And I was like, well, that's promising. I guess we can do long distance HMR by phone and still do the scanning portion. So it depends on your skills level and if you're comfortable with that and if you know what that means, what it looks like when you're scanning. If you haven't been practicing that long on clients in person, you probably don't have that much information that you're getting as you do that. But scanning behind the heart, in front of the body, what it means. We can walk through different somatic sites and what it means if that's helpful. I generally do that as we're practicing the energy portion at level two. And so different kinds of sensations mean different things as you're scanning. But for the most part, the clients seem to be doing quite well with visual access. Karen, who I think is here today, I see a Karen lit up there. It's Karen from Vietnam. Are you there, Karen? Oh, no, that's Karen Lewis that's there. Okay, we're waiting on the other Karen. Karen Gay from, that's in Vietnam. Karen's here. Oh, there you are. See, now I see you. I see your green dots behind your head. There you go. You were missing for a second. Yay, perfect time. She sent me a question actually relating to this kind of about reframing and the use of color in clients. A really important question because I think I've seen many different variations of this. So I'll start with Karen's question. Let me read it to you a little bit about the case of what happened here because it really is significant. Let me say a couple of things. One is as we're starting, anytime you're working on a client, it's a privilege and a sacred trust to work within holographic space. And so when you're working within the mind of a client and their subconscious holographic imagery, it's a privilege, but it's also a sacred trust. You're seeing things. And everything that occurs within the imaging process is significant, has value. So for instance, if they're trying to enact a solution and the colors won't go through any part of the body, won't go through certain areas of the body, there's either another memory there or a sub-memory that's gonna prevent solution moving through the system or the next memory and sequence is already coming up. So like, oh, I'm safe, not here, you're not safe behind your right eye, but everywhere else I'm safe, my throat is not safe, my chest feels okay, but I can move that memory through these parts of my body, but where there is another memory already anchoring or coming up, the safety signal will not move to the area that's still compromised. Now, Karen has a very, very interesting, very educational case that she worked with. So if it's okay, I'm gonna kind of read what you sent me, Karen, if that's okay. So, and this is also about security. We're talking security today. So let's talk about clients with PTSD and vets. A lot of times they said, I can tell you what I did, but I have to kill you afterwards, right? Okay, so what they're saying is they promised that they would be confidential about their military service, if they killed somebody, shot somebody, went into villages, whatever. A lot of times, and if it's sexual abuse, which I think is part of what Karen's looking at, a very sensitive memory that came up, the client didn't want to talk about. Now, the conscious mind often like, I don't want to remember this. I don't want to talk about this. And the subconscious is like, please, can we get this over? Can we release it from the body? I have so much shame about this. You need to work on this. So the higher self consciousness wants the client to work on it. The client in their conscious mind is feeling a bit fragile and like, I don't want to look at this. I don't want to remember what's going on. And remember that HMR works largely with the subconscious mind. So if the memory comes up, they have generally established enough safety for the memory to surface, which is great. But let me just talk about this issue and color solutions and what it means when they won't go through or if there's a negation of the solution. If you're trying to move a color through and like, oh, I'm at my beach scene, I'm bringing my inner child to my beach scene. Oops, the whole beach scene has just vanished. It's not safe anymore. I had a memory of my mother-in-law chasing me with a stick on the beach. I'm like, okay, to get your safe scene back, we need to go into the sub-memory, deal with the mother chasing or the mother-in-law, whatever, chasing you with the stick. And then we go back and enact the solution. That's where you make a note of the memory you're working on and go into a sub-memory and then back up to the memory you were working on afterwards. But in this case, it's quite interesting. So she said, correct me if I'm wrong, this is Karen, but I recall that it is not necessary for the client to verbally state to the practitioner the actual trauma event. Some clients, a very small percentage, don't want to tell you what happened. And you can see they're very uncomfortable disclosing it. So in general, I'll say, well, I don't need to know what it was, but I do need to know that you can see it change and that you can move the color solution all the way through your body. Now, this is interesting because of what happened with her case. Very interesting. Not necessary verbally state to the practitioner the actual traumatic event as long as they can reframe it and bring in the necessary colors. It's bring in the colors and move the colors successfully through the system. But watch what happened when Karen was doing this with her client. So she came up with a reframing solution and a replacement color. But when she tried to fill in the color, it was more like painting it over the metaphor with a new color, and she could still feel the blockage there, still feel the metaphor there. And even before this step, we invited her six-year-old self to her safe place, where the child went bounding off in excitement, but she didn't want to come back for a conversation, which is kind of telling, like, okay. So the six-year-old's like, yeah, I don't mind going to safety, fine, but I don't want to tell you about that memory we're working on. I don't want to go back to that. Now, some clients, I'll say, as a solution, I don't want to see the memory. I don't want to go further into this. I just want to go to the safe scene. So you can invite them and say, would you like to just go to the safe place? Yeah, I'll do that. I don't want to be in that room with that man or anything like that. I don't want to be there. So let's go to the safe place. And the way you know it works is while they're in the safe place, what color do you see around the safe place? Let's move it through your body. But watch what happened in Karen's case. So she said, so the inner child agreed, the six-year-old self wanted to go bounding off in excitement to the safe place, but didn't want to come back and talk about anything. So as I continued talking with my client and inquiring about her spirit team, she had called in to support her. So she had like a healing circle, a healing team to support. But they were unable to remove the metaphor for her, and they kept encouraging her to speak. Now, the metaphor is the container of an actual event. You don't generally have to keep going back to the container as long as you have the event or know what the event is. But if she won't tell you what the event is, all you have is a gauge to determine if it's released is the status, like you said, Karen, of the metaphor. So it said the spirit group, her spirit team, Karen's trying all kinds of innovations here. They were unable to remove the metaphor her, and they kept encouraging her spirit guides, kept encouraging her to speak the event, to tell what the event was, or to talk about it. So my client told me she was only hearing them say this to her. Needless to say, there were a lot of tears, and eventually my client requested that I ask her directly what happened to her six-year-old self. So that the client said, I can't bring it up. I can't bring it up myself, you know, but if you, the six-year-old says, but if you ask me what happened to me, ask me to tell you, perhaps I can tell you what happened. So she said, with an extra gathering of strength, she was able to tell me about the abuse she suffered. That's a very interesting case of internal resistance. Mm-hmm. Like, I want to talk about this. When you see a lot of shame attached to the client's abuse event, especially if it's a new memory, something they've never seen before. I've had clients that say, I had two clients I think of right away. I have to stop. I can't do this today. I'm not strong enough. I don't have the resources. I was like, okay, well, let's work on your resources. So we took the rest of the session, and that's what we did. We worked on their internal resources so eventually they'd be safe enough to talk about it. In one case, the client came back for a second session, and even in that session, she went further into the memory, but she still stopped and said, I'm gonna have to come in. That mirror ball wasn't in my private practice. If I was working with you weekly, we probably would have gotten to it. But at that time, she's like, I'm trying again. She says, but she started shaking actually in the chair and looked like she was about to have a breakdown and trembling. She's like, I think I know what the memory is, but I just can't go there right now. I can't go into that memory. And so you follow, again, HMR is based on the client's safety and the client's ability to work with the memory. And we brought in guides, brought in angels, bring in your guides, know that you're safe, run your safe color through your body. We did that, the client regrounded, it was fine, But the one at Miraval never got to the memory. I mean, we know it's an abusive event. She could kind of tell me about it, but she couldn't herself access the event. The child was so terrified and would start to take over and flood her system that the adult was not able to do that. And in a spa setting, I was not going to push that at all. I was like, well, I hope in the future, because she was seeing in her current life, a lot of fears were coming up for her, and she was projecting onto people around her fear from that original abuse event. And so it had really affected her and her boundaries. Anyway, so back to our account for Karen here. There were a lot of tears. The client eventually asked her directly. So what she did ask about, she said, we did a reframing again. And this time, once she told her about the abuse she suffered, she was able to reframe or remove the metaphor and fill in the replacement color. The metaphor, let me explain. The metaphor is a fragment of the scene, or a symbolic fragment, or a literal fragment. Sometimes you get hit with the golf ball. It is what it appears to be. Or handprint to the face, you know, or somebody punched me, a fist. Sometimes the metaphor is a piece of the actual historical event. There are other times when the metaphors are more symbolic and metaphorical. They're a shape or a feeling, but any kind of geometric. The younger you are, the simpler the geometry, I found. So the metaphor is quite often like a little ball or a knot or a knife or a needle. People use the simpler metaphors, especially if there are young children involved in the memory. But she said in the second, when she did the reframe, she was able, on the reframe, what we're doing with the metaphors is we're actually adding the missing frequencies. So this static, think of it as a static red, black container. When you add the missing frequencies, it goes to white light. And so it returns to flow. It's a static container holding a memory. When you add the missing frequencies, the energy physics of this, so when you add frequencies, it the static resolves. It goes to white light, and it's now a river, a flowing current again. So that part, those meridians and sites in the body are no longer statically held. And so when the metaphor sort of dissolves, like she says, whatever word, resolve the metaphor, reframe, you know, resolve, dissolve. The metaphor is the container that was put in place to contain the pain within the energy and the physiology of the body until we could prove that they're safe. So once you can prove that you're safe, add the missing colors, then it goes to, and that's when you as an empath, or if you're linked to the client, you'll feel it leave, they'll feel it leave. The first time I did in 1992, working on the woman's migraine headache, I felt when it came up. And when she reframed a molestation by her father when he was drunk, and she moved the colors through, I felt waves of pain shooting out of her body at intervals, then it slowed. And then after about 2-3 minutes, I couldn't feel anything. I said, how's your migraine? She said that finished leaving about a minute ago, and I had felt the last wave leave about a minute earlier. So you can feel, you can confirm that the metaphor comes up. You, if you're linked with the system, often they'll say, I'm tingling, my hands and feet are tingling. You say, take all the time you need to keep, and I had a couple of clients this week, keep running the colors through your body so that you, until the tingling stops. Now, if it goes on for quite a while, you say this could go on for a couple of hours or days even. Most of the time it's gone in about 3 to 5 minutes. In some cases, when they're discharging memory from the fingertips, the toes, the hands, and the site, and people whose heart's tingling, their kidneys are tingling, the liver's tingling, they'll feel the organ releasing energy and they'll feel it discharging from the body. So that may go on for a few minutes. You can tell them, keep doing that. And I'm sending you the notes, the colors you use. That's why they like that, the printout, the memory summaries. Make note of their colors. Or if you're handwriting it, remind them what the colors were for each of the memories they did at the end of the session. And then they run that through their body and or Epsom salts baths, things to help discharge. I did several clients doing Epsom salts baths after their memory work this week. So Karen's question was, how important is it for the client to be able to voice their traumatic event with the HMR protocol? There are times I've done the technique and I have no idea what the event was. When I work with vets a lot, I'm like, I'm not allowed to talk about this. I respect that. I just need to know that you can see it, that you can see how you would like to change it, and that you can see the color frame or the color of the solution mechanism and move it through your body. So as long as they can get it, they see it, they know the event, they changed it, they feel safe about it, Now, if they're having trouble with it, I'll say, can you tell me kind of generically a little bit? Is it a physical abuse event, sexual abuse event? Is it a violation? Is it witnessing somebody else get hurt? Can you give me a little more information so I can offer some possible suggestions for solutions if you're stuck? But generally, I'll ask, I'll say, can, if you can picture it, if you can visualize the memory and changing it, I don't necessarily need to know the details of what happened. Now, what's interesting is this. After they've reframed the memory and they've made themselves safe, often they can talk about it. So for example, when I was inpatient and I was working with a client who had a date rape and she'd never been able to tell her family about it or talk about it without getting hysterical. And she did the reframe of the memory in a group process of 5 to 6 other people. She reframed the date rape in front of the group. She reframed it, changed it, punched in whatever, often use more than one solution, like to not be there, and or give the anger back in some appropriate way, maybe both. Sometimes I do both solutions when there's a lot of violence and energy attached to the memory. But she reframed it, ran the colors through her body, and was very calm. And the group session ended. She didn't say too much, except I feel a lot lighter, I feel better. But as she was leaving the session, she walked past the patient lounge and the phone was ringing, coincidentally, right? She went over and she was the only person, she was the person nearest it. She went over and picked up the phone. It was her mother calling to see how she was doing. And she said, oh, I'm doing great. She says, I just did this amazing workshop on trauma. And she said, I finally was able to talk about that date rape that she had mentioned to her mother. She didn't tell the rest of the family. I was able to talk about the date rape. And she said, I was able to reframe it and talk about that. And she went through the whole thing and described it all to her mother. And she got off the phone and she was in shock. She's like, oh, she says, something's really shifted. I've never been able to talk about that memory or any part of it without getting hysterical and getting upset. And she says, there's no charge attached to it. She says, there's no emotional charge attached to the memory. She said, so she was able to talk to her mother and release that. So the things you're looking for, and how I tell my clients at the end of the session to test, people are like, how do we know? It seemed kind of vague. How do I know if that memory is still there or not? I said, think about the event. Is there a feeling or a pain? Is there a charge still attached to it? Or do you feel clear? No, I don't really feel sadness. I feel, and they might say, I feel angry about it. It's like, okay, you dealt with the fear. So in the, when the client's terrified, what Karen was asking about, if they're terrified about talking about the memory, if you can get them to a solution state and ask them about what happened, tell me what happened to you. And what I'll tell them as a resistance breaker, to break the resistance, is if you can talk to me, if you tell, and I sometimes I'll talk to the inner child, or I'm assuming the inner child is blocking, I'll have a little conversation, because HMR is light trance work. And in light trance work, you can do an educational process. I said, we wouldn't ask you, we don't want to bring up anything overly painful, but if we can find out who did this or have some idea what happened to you, we can better protect you in the future so that that perpetrator or bad things don't have to happen again in the future. And if we know who that was from your family, we know how better to protect you and if anyone else needs protection. So if you can talk to us about the memory or tell us about what happened, we can better protect you in the future. And once you reframe a memory, I'll tell the client, once you reframe a memory, usually we don't ever have to go back to it. And that's the problem with HMR, without HMR, is most of the time people have talked and talked and talked about it, they've been through the memory, they keep bringing it up. But if it's that terrifying, what you tell them, once we reframe it and release the charge of the memory, often we don't ever have to go back there because now you're safe with us in present time. You know, you take your inner child to your safe scene, you're in 2020. We don't have to go back to that memory. Now, once they're in the safe scene and you have reframed it and they move the colors through the body, a lot of times there is no charge left to the memory. That pain is gone. There's something else I was going to tell you about that. Once they move the color solution through the body, and I'm sorry, it popped out of my head, but there was another piece to that. I was going to say, once they release the charge, the fear and the terror of the originating event is gone. So what you discover is like, can you tell me a little bit about that event? What happened? Yeah, I can talk about that now. I was about 6 and my uncle was drunk and he was doing whatever to me. And something. I got it unmuted. So be careful what you touch. You never know. It's like everything is potential virus. No, I'm just kidding. You know, I have touched the keyboard somehow and it shut off. But once they've moved through the memory and they're safe, then you can ask, now, can you tell me a little bit, if you want to talk a little bit about what happened to you? Or maybe in the next session, if you want to talk more about that event and what you remember happened to you, we can. But when you think about it now, how do you feel? Oh, I feel calm now. I feel better. How about that metaphor? Is the metaphor still there? No, I think it's gone, but now it's moved to the left. That's a different memory. Please remember, any metaphor change. Well, now, sometimes it'll morph during the work. You may have noticed the metaphor will get smaller, it'll get bigger. Oh, now my shoulder and my stomach's hurting and I'm nauseated and my head is hurting. Like, okay, all we need is one or two metaphors to get to the memory, but your body's starting to bring up the whole thing. Let's just move into the memory. Can you see how young you are? What's happening? And we move into the memory, and it works pretty well that way. So shifts in the metaphor, any metaphor change during the process, it's quite common for metaphors to become art. Also, how many of you have seen the age shift? Everybody's seen the age shift. When you go to ask, how young are you when you're feeling this? Oh, I think I'm 5. Okay. Oh, wait a minute. No, I weren't in that house when I was 5. I'm seven when we're living in that house. I'm like, that's okay. It gave you an impression and a general age range to start with, but it's very, I must have had 6 of the last 30 clients I worked with say, for one of their memories, they'll say, I'm 6. Oh no, wait a minute, I was 8 when that happened. And that's fine. They'll refine it as they narrow in on the scene, as the scene comes up, as they see it, and then they'll get to the age and they'll refine it more for you as they step into it. So it's not uncommon to have the metaphor shift and move on you, but you do want to make sure that the color solution goes through the body, through the whole body if possible, and through the metaphor site. Now, where that metaphor from that memory doesn't go through probably is the next memory in sequence. Like when I scanned long distance, I scanned one client, and the first thing I got was a pain in her left shoulder. The 4th memory, all the pain shifted to her left shoulder. Everything shifted to the left shoulder. So as you get more comfortable with energy and knowing what these things feel like, and that'll probably come when we can get near people again someday, you know, when you can work with them, you can get that information. But I'm like, okay, the mind is the only thing that limits us holographically. There's no reason you can't do long distance holographic scanning work or work with the site. I believe we're also linking with the client to create safety. I do believe that having the energy in your hand on C7 does something to help turn up color perception. And though we can do some long distance, or even at Miraval, I'm going back to Miraval, supposedly June the 5th or 6th, but I'll be working across the room. You know, I think client people are more comfortable with that right now. You work with their level of comfort and safety, so 5-6 feet away. So I'm going to be doing that for a while. I do have some clients probably coming in starting in June while I'll be back with physical contact. But so I'm not sure, Karen, if I answered. So how important is it for the client to voice their traumatic event? Sometimes they don't even know what the traumatic event is. They're like, I don't know. I'm just in the dark and I'm scared. If they're in the dark and they're scared, you say, can we turn on the light to take away the scary part? Can we turn on the light? Yeah, but I don't see anything. I don't know. I can't see that. I can't. Okay, can we just invite that part to go to the safe scene? Now, sometimes this is an intermediate solution. We don't have the real memory. They're not ready to talk about it. And this is back to Karen with this question. The client isn't necessarily ready to talk about it, but I'll ask, can't she just go with you to the safe place for now? And then once she's safe, maybe she'll be able to talk about it a little more if she needs to. Oh, my inner child is there. She's 4. Does she want to talk about it? No, she's out playing on the beach with a beach ball. Okay. So she doesn't want to talk about the memory. And for right now, she's safe. Now, if the subconscious is insisting that you do need a more of a solution and you need to go back to that memory, what's going to happen? In the subsequent session, that metaphor will return. She'll be 4 again. And then you go a little deeper into the memory. Worst come to worst, the memory's not resolved. It's going to be still in the body. And it's going to come back to you. But if you can make the child safe, and some memories, sometimes I think children, I said this to one of my clients in the past few weeks, I think sometimes people close their eyes during the abuse when they knew something was going to happen, and they didn't see the face of the perpetrator. They don't even want to know who they are as an infant or as a young child. Or maybe the light wasn't on and they can't figure out. I think at some level they probably know who it was, but they don't want to know who it was. And so if they didn't see it, we won't get it. So you work with the client's limitations, okay? Can we just move her to the safe place? Can we bring her to your safe place? And they'll either say yes or no. And if they say no, then you got more resistance coming up. Once we get at level 3, I talk about that, we have a lot of resistance. We did this one client in the past few weeks. Can we give her a bunny or a kitty or a puppy or something to make her feel safe? Boom, she took the puppy and she ran off. Okay, well, that's fine. Tell her to keep the puppy as long as she wants and to play with the puppy. And whenever she's ready to talk about the memory, she can talk to us about it. But we're just here to help. And when she feels safe, we'll talk about the event. So you can get lots of different kinds of resistance that come up like that. Sometimes it resolves during the session. If you keep creating safety, is there anything else she needs to feel safe? Yeah, she wants a puppy. She wants a kitty. Let's give her a puppy or a kitty now and let her know we're not here to hurt her. We're not here to cause any harm. But if she can tell us who hurt her, we can protect her, help protect her so that never happens again. The adult, you can help protect her so that never happens again. And so I do language like that sometimes, have a little discussion about safety when it's helpful. Because you can pause the process, an educational process. And the child, oftentimes the client, the conscious adult client may not know it, but I'm talking to the inner child. So I'm like, you need to know we're not here to hurt you. And I've worked with thousands of inner children and we're not going to make you go anywhere you don't want to go or talk about anything you don't want to talk about. But if we can find out where you're stuck, we can bring you, let's show you a picture of the safe place. We can go to the safe place and we never need to go back to the scary place again. We never have to go back to that scary place. So those are a couple of different things about, but in this case, when it really is graphic and violent, I think there are some memories that are not going to resolve unless they articulate what happened. So Karen, you're right about that. And that's interesting that you were good. You brought in the support, like we call that the healing circle, level 3, bring in support, people that love her unconditionally, spiritual guides, whatever, bring in your spiritual support team. There's a client when I did ritual stuff with clients inpatient that she'd bring in her cult ritual, her ritual abuse SWAT team. And I was part of the SWAT team. So she'd bring in the police, break into the facility, save her from the event, rescue her, you know, bring her to safety, run colors through her body, you know, and then reframe the memory eventually with her. But she had her own SWAT team. So people, like you said, Karen, you can bring in your spiritual guides, find out what their spiritual resources are. If there's a lot of resistance, build in additional resources. What makes them safe? Do they have an animal guide? One of my clients had an animal. I think it was a jaguar. Something showed up in their memory suddenly, spontaneously this week. Like, oh, bring in any animal guides. Or at the end of the session, I think an animal guide came in. So work with whatever resources. Make a note of that. Work with the safety resources. But there are cases where if they don't get... Here's the key. If you're not in the key feeling, if you don't fully access T-1, there is a possibility that the memory solution is not going to reframe. It won't release. It's kind of like you can talk about cleaning your closet. People do talk therapy all the time about trauma. But if you're not actually in the closet with the feeling, you can't reframe it and move in the solution. So if you're not actually at T-1, and Karen, that's what you're really asking. If the client isn't authentically in the core pain moment and isn't actually at T-1 and articulating that, at least for a millisecond, is it going to resolve? And sometimes it will not. That's the problem we had with the benzodiazepines. You'll get everything, every detail of the memory. It's black, it's heavy, I'm 5, he's about to molest me. You know, even I'm scared. They might get the feeling and say what the feeling is. But when they go to move the solution through the body, guess what happens? Kind of like the benzos do what you're talking about. They lock out the metaphor. It will not go through the system, the T-1 moment, part of the body, and create a shift. It doesn't shift. The brain waves are slowed down sufficiently that the reframing doesn't occur with benzodiazepines. They'll come back the next week, repeat the same memory, and the charge is intact. The memory is intact. And they even know what it is, but they can't feel it. So whatever that part of the brain is that accesses the T-1 core emotional content is what color targets. And when the color targets that key moment of freezing, of pausing, of, that's a very spiritual trust, when the consciousness itself is paused for a person to survive. If you can move the missing frequencies through that part of the body and show that as an adult or an older self, they can move the missing frequencies to that part of consciousness that is paused for survival. If they can move those colors through the body, says, oh, look, she has our missing frequencies. We're safe. The bad thing is over. And at that point, the trance breaks, so to speak, or dissolves, and energies, the energy, original static, painful, violent energy of the body. I had a therapist sit in with me once, and she brought me her client because she couldn't get to the trauma memory. It was an airplane crash. The client was in the airplane crash and was wearing a set of clothes. When she reframed the memory and released it from her body, the therapist, who I think she knew, she was fairly intuitive, she said when she moved her colors through her body, I saw the whole memory played out in my head. I saw the plane crash. I can tell you what she was wearing. I can tell you what her bag was on the seat next to her when the whole thing crashed. She said, I saw the whole event, and I don't think she smelled it. The client smelled it, and saw it. The therapist saw it, but when she reframed it, it left the body. And when that signal releases, it's a transmission. I understand for your office too, folks. Energy is leaving the client's body and going through your office. It's going through your body. It's going through the house. It's going through your space, your sacred space. It's releasing from your body. It's releasing from the client's body. And if you're there with her, you'll feel it release. And the waves, the first time I ever did the technique, and I knew this was an energy transaction, I felt the waves leave and go through my hands, and my hands stopped hurting. I'm like, what was that? Something left the body. I said, how does your migraine feel? Well, that finished leaving a minute ago. And I said, I felt it leave. She said, so did I. And that's when I first had a clue that this was an empathic thing. You could actually feel this dense energy leaving the body. So when it discharges from the system, it leaves, it goes to your office. You really want to be at a pretty high frequency so that it doesn't download into you. If you have any suggestions or indicators that it's downloading into you, check your history for a similar memory. The only time I've seen it download to me is if it triggered a memory similar to my own that I hadn't resolved, and it's kind of downloading into my system. Or if you're sick and you're weaker and you have a frequency and the frequencies are downloading into your body, you need to take care of yourself and enhance your self-care. But that moment when you move the colors through, the metaphor generally does release, and you can go back and check the body. Is that still there? I think probably this week, when I asked that question, 92% said, no, that's not there, but it's moved up. That's not there, but it's moved down. Now it's flatter. There's still a fist, but it's not as tight. Oh, now it's amorphous. It's not a fist anymore. It's just a blob. It's a ball. And it's a lot less. So these are the things that happen to metaphors. They'll morph during the session. If it's moving the solution color through the metaphor, it changes shape, size, color, weight, intensity. It's a different memory. You're into the next memory. Okay, that covers a little bit about metaphors. And Carol, did that answer? I mean, Karen, did that answer your question about that?
For the most part, it did. I do want to say that my client was definitely, she knew what that T1 mm-hmm. event was. It was more, my question is more, and you answered it earlier on in terms of how important it is to voice that. So I was saying in the email that we know that speaking about whatever can be very healing. Mm-hmm. Now, for the process, and you identified that earlier, for the process to be successful, whether or not the person has to be able to speak that specific trauma event, as you were saying, if they're not able to bring the colors through, then it's going to come back. It's going to be something that is going to revisit them. So in this particular case, what was for me very striking was that she could see it, but what the limiting thing was the voicing it. And so when she actually was able to put it out into space, into the air, and share it, that's when she was able to move the colors through.
I hear you. Mm-hmm.
And so the other piece to that, though, is that she never would have come in to see me had she known that that was going to come up and it was going mm-hmm. to be a discussion around that. There was no way. And we talked about that at the end. And yeah, she just, because it was the first time that she'd shared that with anybody. And so we, of course, created that safe space and she was eventually able to share it. But if she was thinking like therapy or whatever that, oh, you know what, this issue I've been carrying around for years, I'm going to finally go. No, that was, she came in to talk about, you know, and just in relationship issues at work or in other environments, like, why is it that I just freeze, that I shut down? Why do I not voice what's really happening in, with me? Like, I just kind of go blank. People kind of know that I'm there, but I'm not there. And then afterwards, she starts having these, like, removed from the situation, she will have, you know, that whole dialogue where you're speaking for the other person. She has this exchange in her head back and forth, and she beats herself up about what she should have said or why did that other person say this or support me, blah, blah, blah. So that lack of not feeling able that she was able to speak or to get the support that she needed. So here we have this is this T1 event where this is where this is why this is now as an adult, she's unable to feel that she's able to voice herself, get support. Because what was happening was, is she was, there was an abuse situation that was happening from a household help. And then a distant relative that was living with the family at the time saw what was happening. It was a female house helper. And this male relative said, if you allow me to do the same to you, or I'm going to tell your grandmother. So that was the trigger, and then that, she said she didn't know how long that went on for, but it was this sort of situation where, again, not being able to speak, to get the support, to get the help that you need. And that was just, that was playing out, manifesting in all areas of her life in terms of just general relationships at work, where she wasn't able to, again, express what she needed and why. The other piece of that was why others couldn't see that she needed the support that she needed. So
this happens a lot with relationship issues.
She never would have come in.
Yeah, I can see that. And quite honestly, that happens probably weekly for a lot of us with clients that we're working with. The thing they think they're coming in. The problem with HMR is when you I should say the depth of HMR's review, when, you know, it took me 150,000 memories, almost 30,000 clients to refine the language. And one of the things we do is, how young might you be when you first feel this issue? And the decision you have to make sometimes when you work with that is, if you say, how old are you when you're feeling all this? They'll go to the most recent occurrence in some cases. If you say, how young are you when you first feel this kind of shame or fear about, like, you're being threatened or somebody is not letting you speak your truth, then, like, oh, I see the number 5. Can you see where you are when you're 5? Now, if you hadn't created enough safety for her, it's a tribute to you, she wouldn't have gotten the memory. Obviously, you created enough safety for her to be able to talk about that. 95% of couples conflict, those of you that do couples work, I'm convinced 90-95% of couples conflicts don't have to do with the current couple. So what you discover, I like working with couples, because 90% of the time when I do HMR, I don't have to do any discussion with the couple about their communication patterns, although Imago is a helpful resource in learning to mirror and listen accurately. But the majority of the time, how old are you when you're that angry at somebody violating your boundaries, not hearing you? I'm 6. And the couples begin to realize that the things they're triggering on for each other don't have to do with them, that have to do with the partner's childhood and history, and they haven't done their work. So a lot of times, you know, you do have to deal with the fact that what comes up when you ask the question. Now, what I tell my clients is, you understand, pause for a moment, you wouldn't be remembering this if you weren't now safe enough in your life to recall it. HMR is a self-applied technique. It's facilitated self-dehypnosis. So you're helping people gain enough resources and safety to take themselves out of where they're stuck. Now, you're right. If a lot of people said, oh, let's go do therapy for any kind of sexual abuse you've had. I don't have any sexual abuse. I don't remember anything. I don't think that happened to me. I don't want to work on that. I've already resolved that in therapy. Well, if they did only talk therapy, it's not resolved. And then you're going to have to deal with what I call therapy trauma. You know, it's like, okay, now it's coming up again. Why is it coming up? Why is it coming up? I already did therapy. I talked about this. I've done primal scream therapy, allotropic breath work, Bataka work, and I've blown up a few things. I've done some other stuff to release all this trauma. I breathe myself until I'm purple. You know, I've done all this therapy, Bataka work, family of origin work, and I've done all these therapies, and I can't believe the damn memory's still intact. And I'm like, you know, quite honestly, on a personal level, folks, sometimes I'd rather people not having done a day of therapy until you meet them. And like, oh, let's start with HMR. I'll show you this very gentle, non-intrusive technique for being able to release things from your body without reliving things. And I'm sorry you had the impression that that perpetrator, that you resolved all those memories with your 13 years of psychoanalysis twice a week. But the reality of it is the trances are still intact. I know that's a home in the Hamptons for some people. You know, I said that the trances are still intact in your body. And I said that to the extent you've reduced it by talking about it. At least I hope that's the case of the talk to reduction. But you reduce the charge, but the core charge of a memory sometimes, and this is back to Karen's comment, sometimes the only thing left intact is the container. And the charge is released. So I had a client, their clients I've worked on for years, and all they ever did was throw out metaphors. They did 12-step work, they did all their list work, they did all kinds of retreats and deep processing stuff, but they never knew to take out the container and put back the color solution. All that's left to their trauma history. So usually often within a session with a client, it's not uncommon to have a metaphor. What's that? I love in my throat. Inside or outside? Inside has spikes. Anything else? It's tight, it hurts, it burns. How young are you when you first feel this? I have no idea. Is this something, is there an emotion word for this? No, it's kind of hard to swallow physically. Is there a scene or an image? Does it feel familiar? Does this feel like an old metaphor? I don't think so. What would you like to do with a spiky ball like that? Flush it down the toilet? Well, let's take all the time you need to do that. Can you picture that? Yes. Let me know when you've done that, and they'll say, okay, I've done that. What color comes to you to replace that? I see cerulean blue. Let's move cerulean blue or Caribbean blue all the way through your body, and it's gone. And if it's gone, what does that tell you? You don't need to go into the memory. They've already released the emotional charge. It's not required. This is color replacement. And so sometimes the metaphor you can just throw. It's not uncommon to have one. I don't get an age. I don't get a look. Let's just try. Sometimes, folks, they're stress metaphors. They're not traumas. They're just stress metaphors. But by our definition of what a trauma is, if it's frozen as an icon of pain, technically, really, that is a trauma. So what Milton Erickson's protege said is, stress causes a spontaneous state of freezing or self-hypnosis to protect you from overwhelm. Stress does it. So understand, include in your description, HMR works with stress. We do a lot of work with anxiety with people, but stress, anxiety, a lot of OCD stuff going on. Very interesting, some success with that, actually. But stress, anxiety, small T trauma, and big T trauma. Generally, we think, oh, there's a metaphor. It has to be something traumatic. Not necessarily, but when clients get the metaphor and they go to look at it, like in Karen's case, ooh, it's too scary. Let me talk about shame for a moment. Sometimes the metaphor that's coming up is the first abuse event, the shame event. But if there's another 15 or 20 that are still repressed, it's going to be really, really hard for them to bring up the first one. because it feels like they're not bringing up, you know, this much shame. They're bringing up a room full of shame, and they don't know why. So sometimes I wouldn't be surprised to find that something like this happened to the client in other instances. And that if they're that terrified of bringing that up, there is a possibility that the abuse is actually a pattern and not just an isolated event. At which point, the reason the shame is so overwhelming trying to come up with this person is it's not just the little single thing that's happening, but oh my God, it's triggering my whole shame thing, and then what happens to me if it triggers the bigger. Now that's where you talk about level two. Let's pile up all the shame. If you can picture that person at a safe distance, pile it all up. That also gives you as a therapist a sense about how extensive the abuse was. If we can invite all the little girls terrified of feeling shame, we could take them all to your safe scene. Can you see how many ages and moments could show up in the safe scene with us that would like to all be safe in 2020? How many show up there with you? And the language focuses on how many show up, not can you move them. How many show up? And they'll tell you how many times the abuse occurred. There are 62 children there, there are 23. There are 7 of them. It happened 7 times. I can see 7 kids. Okay. You were going to say
that would be yes, sorry to interrupt. That would be the next session, because she did say that it was more than once. That was the first time, and that she didn't know. So there is this blockage in terms of the memory as to the start and finish. She knows
right.
that it
and
went
sometimes
on.
It's scary because they don't know how often it occurred. Sometimes I have a client I've worked with probably on and off for about 2 years, occasionally on the phone. And every time we think we've finished all the memories with her, there's another younger, earlier memory that comes up that was repressed. And she's down back to 3-4 years old in the same cabin, the same uncle, same place. Family went there for every summer for vacation from infancy to later. So she worked with some of the teenager later events, but they're getting younger and younger, and they move backwards in time. And those were the ones that seem to have been scarier. It's like she doesn't have any context and no safety. So it's true that when it comes up, it can be a pattern. And so when I was thinking about shame, the reason the shame might feel overwhelming is she's not just tapping like the shame from that one event. It's tapping the larger holographic body of shame. And she, rightfully so, is really reluctant to bring something up when it feels like it's opening a can of worms and this whole huge thing is going to come up. She's right. If the hologram is by nature tapping into any vibrationally similar memories. So when you trigger that one memory, it's going to start trying to encourage the others to come up as well. And so sometimes if you do see that starting to happen, like, okay, let's do a level two on this. And, you know, let's create a safe distance, make sure you're safe, picture the perpetrator. If we could pile up in front of him all the shame he ever caused you, how big a pile is that? Taller than he is. What would you like to do with that? Now, if we could bring all the little girls, parts of you he shamed, to safety, can you see how many there are? And that will actually give you a handle on the extent of the level two abuse and how extensive it might be. But you have to kind of bide your time. I wouldn't do that too early on in the process. But what happens is you might need to give them level two relief for a larger pattern before you can go back to doing individual memories. But sometimes they just want to go memory by memory, and then eventually they'll do a level two on the pattern. So it really varies per client. So I can't give you an answer on that. You're doing great with the client you're working with, though. You're like, okay, well, that's all we need to do for now. Let's create safety and reinforce safety afterwards. Make sure they do the grounding thing in their bodies, that they're safe, two-finger thing afterwards, you know? Donna Eden's hookup, two-finger. Look it up on the internet, the hookup, Donna Eden. Dominant finger on the forehead. So I do the higher line below the navel. She does the navel, I think, but I do the higher line a little bit below it to anchor the body so they're safe. Use your safe color. And lately, I've had an insomnia case that I'm pretty sure was from a childhood violence. There's some insomnia cases you can work with. Always check for violence, nightmares, riot, loud noises, things weren't safe. Father used to get drunk and break into the room in the middle of the night and beat the crap out of the client. Would just burst in the middle of the night. And now that we're doing this work, client's having some insomnia issues. I'm like, that's not insomnia. There's a chance it's PTSD. But we'll check on that. you could be in menopause or menopause, right? You know, have other issues. Poor Antoinette hasn't slept in what, 12 years or something. I don't know. You know, I'm just picking on you. But, you know, the hormonal surges during menopause are their own separate issues. But I look for it first. What are you and I here for? We're talking about trauma techniques. So what we're looking for is what keeps people awake. We haven't talked insomnia about much insomnia before. But in this case, the father was breaking in childhood and beating him in the middle of the night. For no apparent reason, no explanation, no rationale. He's drunk. He's just coming in and wanting to beat somebody. And so this suddenly this client's like, I'm like, have you always been alone? Yeah, I've always been kind of a light sleeper. I said, you're in PTSD, you're a hypervigilant trauma survivor, and you're not sleeping at night because you're trying to stay awake in case somebody breaks into your room. I said, was this reinforced? And he had several things that happened at nighttime and other people and events that happened to people tragic, traumatically at night. He has reason to not be sleeping at night. I said, I'm not surprised you're wide awake. I said, with all that PTSD you have at nighttime, we need to reframe this. And I said, one thing I want you to start doing to it, we did the enhanced safe scene, which we talk about at level 3. Well, our create your beach house and bring a building to your safe scene. I want you to create a bedroom inside your safe scene where it's safe to sleep. The kind of bed, the kind of pillows, the scents, the smells, the security system. Make everything safe the way you want it. And for the next few nights, I want you to sleep, go to sleep inside your safe scene. So for some of my clients with insomnia, I'm asleep inside the safe place. Same thing, if the client, they're abused in the middle of the night or molested in the nighttime, let's make sure that inner child for today is sleeping in the safe place with you. And those that have seen Harry Potter, I'm like, it's like a Harry Potter safe house, which means you can open the door and it has an infinite number of rooms inside the safe house, even though from the outside it looks like a cute, quaint little cabin or something. So you can have the client's holographic subconscious safe place have unlimited numbers of rooms. And each part of them can have its own room if it needed to sleep peacefully at night. So it's something to think about in terms of safe scenes. Other questions, other parts about that, Karen? So I was going to say something about that whole shame issue. I think a lot of times they're showing this huge reaction to shame, and it looks like one memory, but I'm saying sometimes, like you said, she wasn't reacting to just the one memory. It's the one memory, and probably what she doesn't even remember that it's attached to. There are other memories there. There are other instances. And until those are addressed, she's probably going to have anxiety about, and sometimes they try to stop seeing you. They're like, I didn't come to you to have all this stuff come up. I'm like, you know what? My line is, I'm more afraid about you leaving this kind of toxic memory in your body and not reframing it. Because that kind of repression of your immune system from a traumatic memory, if left intact in the cells and meridians, can make you sick, can make you ill. That's the way the body works. When triggers are present and cortisol goes up, your T cell and immunity go down. If that trigger keeps being bombarded without being released, that part of your body where the metaphor is stored is part of your immune system that is being repressed. And you could get sick. So I'm more worried about you not releasing the traumatic memory than the anxiety and fear about you having it coming up. My fear as the trauma therapist is the opposite. I'm afraid you're not going to fully release it, and it could leave you with a risk factor. I don't want you holding on to this. I don't want you staying in danger in your subconscious. I don't want your inner child or any part of you left in an unsafe location or place. And so I would encourage you to, I know it's scary, but I'm not going to make you do anything you're not ready to do. And I'll say, by the way, the memory won't even come up in your body as a metaphor if your subconscious doesn't believe you're safe enough to access it. Your inner wisdom, your wise woman. Now, one thing we go to sometimes, we appeal to the inner wise woman, your medicine man, yourself that 5-10 years down the road has already healed all of this, you know, and has already your higher self, your future self. We work with that. We have a wise woman self that says, yeah, your wise woman self is cheering for you. Let's get this out of your body now before consequences occur. Because we know you leave it in your body long enough, the immune system is compromised. We get cysts, we get fibroids. We're good people with cysts this week, fibroids that are recurrent, you know, and they find the memories. I'm like, yeah, I can see what caused that. I was date raped when I was 11. and nobody in my family believed me or supported me. I had terrible messages about it's not safe to be a woman, it's not safe to be sexual, and all the issues that come from working with that. I had a client, she worked on her fibroids, ran colors through, and they went away. They stopped. If she stopped doing the work and stopped meditating or sending color through her body, they tended to want to come back until we found the core memories and released that. And then I didn't see her again after the years after, so I'm assuming they stopped in all likelihood. So, but I know I can make them go away. She says, when I meditate and take care of myself, the fibroids stop. She says, when I don't, they start growing back faster than they've been able to even remove them. So she knew, she had the history, and they were taking x-rays and monitoring them. So she knew that part. So we're talking about the power of metaphors. Metaphors are very amazing things, aren't they? They're how we were, the metaphor is a gift that's given to the client to contain some inordinate, overwhelming pain, a threat of death or overwhelm. And the metaphors, as subtle as they are, people are like, oh, I know it doesn't have a color, it doesn't have a weight. I said, good, that's the answer. Do you realize you just answered the question? No, no weight, no temperature, no texture. Do I have enough information to go forward? I said, yes, you answered all the questions. You said, no, it doesn't have a shape. No, it doesn't have a color. It doesn't have a size. You're answering the question correctly. All I need is one descriptor to go forward in time. And when you say, no, it's just heavy, that is the answer. It's perfect. It is the perfect answer. Because it's saying, no, it doesn't have a shape, size, color, weight, temperature, texture. It doesn't have any of those things. It's just freaking heavy. How old are you? 7. Can you see where you are? And you're 10. So it's not the number of the 9 to 15 answers, the parts you're asking about. All you need is one to go forward. Now, if you don't get an age, you don't get location, don't get event, don't get a feeling, it's not a pattern, it's not level 2, they don't think it's old, it hasn't been there before, what do you do with it? Throw it away, replace with color, blow it up, get the metaphor out of the body. It's a color replacement. They may have already done the emotional work in the holotropic breath work or the primal screen therapy. They may have released the charge. They didn't know to get rid of the container. And so the physiological container can remain intact and maintain part of the memory. And that's the piece that's left, even after talk therapy. A lot of times it's the little container. The nice part about HMR is we make sure that the container's also been released from the system. And if you miss it or it's wrong, it's going to come back and tell you. I have clients that come in and said, I did a solution last week and the metaphor went away for a while, but then I thought about that, like, I don't like that solution, and it came back. So I want to do a different solution. So I want to actually blow him up. I was like, oh, well, let's do that. Take all the time you need to blow up the perpetrator. But they're not afraid of it anymore, then they tap into their anger or other emotions about that. So anymore. Bless you. Bless you, Miss Glenda. Good. Other questions? Hey, did that... Karen, are we getting closer to answering your question now, I think? Okay, good.
Okay. May
Other
I
questions,
ask?
Cases? Sure. Ms. Ramona, you always have some colorful people.
Yes. I'm working with a client that has nightmares from a long time, and she's on Paxil and occasionally smokes pot. So she doesn't remember the first nightmare, but I think we got it this time. But I keep on reframing the same thing, like she's waking up because her dog wakes her up due to the screaming, or somebody in the family wakes her up because she's screaming. So I'm not so sure how am I going
about it. I don't know, is she remembering? She remembers the nightmare? When she wakes up, does she remember?
Sometimes she does, sometimes she just remembers waking up.
Okay, you got two problems on your hands here, because Paxil is the only antidepressant that clients have used that can inhibit visualization. Mm-hmm. I had a client, most people, they stopped giving it. I'm surprised they even give it. I haven't heard a client in years on Paxil. But anyway. Hello. So yeah. One of the things with Paxil can inhibit color visualization. I had a client who they had just adjusted her dosage, and she said, I'm having trouble visualizing. She said, in fact, right now I can't even visualize my children's faces. Mm. I can't picture what my children look like. Like, okay, that's pretty nasty. So Paxil does have a visual access repressant function. We know that. So that's problem number one. Number two is marijuana and pot. I'm getting more and more suspicious. That's from Mary Gaddy. We got to get Mary Gaddy back with us again. to do the research on marijuana and alpha theta. I know it represses alpha theta because it represses nightmares. That's why they smoke pot, so they don't have dreams. They don't remember the dreams. That may be why she's smoking pot. She's asking you to work on her nightmares and stop them, but she's smoking enough marijuana, she can't remember them. Teenagers smoke pot so that they can't remember them. It creates what they call black, they came up with the term black sleep. So it induces black sleep and stops the nightmare access. Actually, I think with your client, it's not stopping her nightmares, she's still having them, but if it wasn't for the dog, she might never know she's having them. Because it's repressing the, you know, if it stops nightmares, dream world is alpha theta.
Now I'm a bit confused because they say nightmare to all the anxious dreams.
They say, right? What? I'm sorry, I missed that part.
So they say, oh, I had a nightmare, but in fact it was an anxious dream. It wasn't a nightmare related, a dream related to the trauma.
Well, you know, here's the thing. This is, nightmares are easy to work with, not complicated. It's a hologram. So if they remember the nightmare, you can work with it. If they're having nightmares that you can't access, yeah, that they're too drugged to get access. If she can give you what the nightmare is. So I was excited like 20 years ago because I found nightmares thought for kids and for people when I did this. When you think about your, what's the protocol? Let's go through the nightmare protocol. When you think about your nightmare, where do you feel that in your body?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what's the, eventually you get to what's the feeling coming up?
Yeah.
When you feel that feeling, here's the question. So it's a lump, it's tight, it makes me anxious, I'm fearful after the nightmare, I really can't hardly sleep, I'm so anxious in my chest, in my throat. What's the question? That will determine how you proceed. How young might you be? How old are you when you first have this fear? Now that is either gonna take you to what? It's either gonna take you to the event that created the nightmare, I will bring you back to the nightmare itself. Now, so how young are you when you first felt that? 5, can you see where you are? Yeah, mommy, daddy, 5 a.m. Or, you know, I'm so scared. Okay, so they're frightened at night, and so what's happening is they're getting the nightmares after domestic violence or something like that. Mm-hmm. Now, so then you change the event. What's the event? Mom and dad are fighting, and I'm terrified, and that's when I had my first nightmare. I'm not gonna be safe. Okay, let's reframe that. More commonly, though, how old are you when you first feel that? I don't remember ever having a teenage. I haven't felt this before. Okay, so can you see where you are in the nightmare? Tell me what's happening in the nightmare. And so when we go to the nightmare, what we do is we end up changing the nightmare itself. So example, I had a nightmare where I had I think I shared this with somebody. A Raggedy Ann doll about 6'3" was chasing my sister with a machete or something like that, or an axe. So like, okay, I'm my sister's protector, and this is a little scary. Like, first of all, if I could change that, what would I like to see happen? I said, let's change Raggedy Ann back to the size of the Raggedy Ann doll. Let's get rid of the axe, and let's lock the toy in. This is like Chucky from hell. You know, Chucky really giant. So, let's put Chucky in a toy box with a lock on it. Chucky can't get out, right? And we put the Raggedy Ann doll back in the box, locked it up, and nightmare never occurred. Nightmare was gone. They stopped it. So the good news is nightmares are holographic space. Now, in my first book, The Healing Dimensions, there's a chapter on dreams, and I cite 12 different kinds of dreams in that book. So 3 of them are based in historical memory. The rest are not. They're archetypal composites. So you can have your subconscious can combine all of your trauma history and bring it into a single dream so you can work on a theme or an issue. Okay.
Yeah.
So then what you do is you heal or work on the dream itself. You work on the memory.
I did.
Within the dream. Yeah. I'm sorry, you work within the dream itself. So that'll be whatever possible. How would you like to change the nightmare? Well, I'd like to have the dog be like a puppy, not like a wolf trying to eat me. I'd like to have, you know, whatever it is. So you're just going to have to work with the client's imagery and make it non-threatening and harmless. Is it safe now? Yes. What color frame do you see? Run that color through your body where you felt the nightmare. That nightmare will not come back. Now, they might get others. They might get different ones, but that one will not return. So nightmares are holograms. They're pretty easy to work with. But when you want to track it and see, is it based in historical memory? Then you have nightmares that are visitation dreams. You have dreams that are, you ate a banana before you went to bed. You got a metabolic dream going on here, folks, from eating the banana. You know, so there are a lot of different kinds of dream sources here. But if it's based in historical events, or if it scared you, frightened you, change the details, frame it, and run that color through your body. I would doubt that that particular nightmare or dream occurs in its form. And people, a lot of times, they know the recurrent nightmare from childhood. Oh, yeah, I had a lot of childhood nightmares. Can we work on that? Sure, do you remember? Oh, yeah, I had one that was really bad. Tell me about that. Of course, if you know their history, my gift is I'm a matrix thinker, so if I know their history pretty well and they give me the nightmare, I've almost always been able to show where the nightmare came from in their history. Because the figures that are represented and how they're acting it out are clearly mom or dad or the event that happened with the kids or the brother or somebody. And you can see the pieces and like, oh, look, there's a pattern in your nightmare. That happened three times in your life, in your history that you shared with me. So I think it could be coming from these things. And if I'm right and we tag it correctly and we find the column, we run it through, it will not come back.
Yeah, she also struggles with trichotillomania, like she pulls out her hair. Mm. So we reframe that time.
That ties into OCD and anxiety stuff. That's tying into childhood anxiety and fears and things of that sort. I have a client who spontaneously loses hair when she goes into the States because she starts producing so much adrenaline. She's like borderline, but she hyperreacts with violent feelings and hatred, and it surges into her system from her violent mother, her childhood, and then she tries to suppress it. The next thing you know, she's losing more hair because she doesn't have control when the adrenaline surges are coming up and memories are triggered. We've reduced it, it's better, and she's learning to reduce the intervals where she freaks out, but it's complicated. Borderlines are complicated to work with.
Yeah, thank you.
Sure. Other questions? You're all doing great. You all look healthy. Looks good. You're all still locked up.
I have a question about a client that I've been working with.
Colleen. Yes.
Yeah. So she has done HMR a couple times, so she's familiar with it, and did a wonderful HMR with her, reframing some memories that she forgot about her grandmother, who was one of the, you know, only nurturing people in her life. But she is, you know, we're discussing how she's being triggered, especially by like the current crisis and how the government's handling it and how other people are, you know, not wearing masks and protecting other people. So she's being triggered right now. So, and I've heard somebody else has told me like now is not the time to be working on trauma. And so I just kind of wanted to get your feedback about, should we kind of just go into what's being triggered, or should we wait until she's feeling a little more safe?
People that are afraid of trauma work often don't know about HMR. They think that to access the trauma work means reliving it and driving down the immune system, getting worse. They don't understand that if you can find, why are you being overly triggered about what other people are doing, being responsible or irresponsible? Why are you being so, why do you feel like your safety is so compromised, or is that compromised? So in a way, yes, you can. I think you can work with that. That's why I sent out the emails originally. I said, actually, it's a perfect time. What happens is this is so similar to September the 11th, when financial markets, uncaught perpetrator, can't see the perpetrator. They don't know who's doing it. Don't know when you're going to be safe. Can't fly. Airlines are shut down. Travel shut down for a while. You know, it has similarities to people's September the 11th stuff. So some of that got triggered with this. And then financial markets and instability and fear. I believe our responsibility is, if you're going to stay calm, I know for myself, I'm not going to like, oh, it's not time for HMR, not time for trauma work. We're too traumatized. Excuse me, you're not going to make it through all this very easily if you're not monitoring your triggers and staying clear as you're going through it. So I'm like, they're just miseducated. A lot of HMR is, you know, technically by the IRS, I'm an educational process, a consulting process that helps people reduce the impact of trauma in their lives. That's what HMR is in the eyes of the IRS. So, okay, that's what I'm labeling this. a consulting corporation that helps people reduce the impact of trauma. But when people are triggered, like overly triggered, and they're fearful, now it's true, you could be dealing with a whole personality issue with that much codependency. I'm worried about people not wearing their masks. I'm so angry at them. They're not making me feel safe. You know, they're people have their opinions. Some people want to go back to work. Some people are losing their businesses because their restaurants are so shut down that they're not even going to be able to make payments, and they're going to end up closing and losing their livelihood. They're in terror. So it's a debate between how can we do this? How can we do it safely? So what I do is say, you know, each person, it's like when September the 11th occurred, people are like, oh, there must be like a September the 11th trauma. No, there's no September the 11th trauma. It's how did you see it? How did you hear it? How did you find out about it? How personally impacted were you and your body by it? And so when people are triggered by COVID-19, I'm like, okay, did you have a loved one that died of a disease in front of you suddenly? Did you have people who didn't exercise health precautions around you as a child when they didn't listen to you? If you were ever unheard, unseen, I had clients this week. I'm working on everybody that wasn't heard, wasn't seen. Their feelings, their needs were ignored as a child. They weren't respected. And so what ended up happening? It's like, okay, all this stuff is encoded as trauma because nobody's listening to them. And so a lot of people being feeling unheard, unseen, unprotected, unsafe. So a lot of trauma, it's just all over. It's in the media, it's how they're handling it. So yes, there are things you can work with. Same thing Andrew Weil said, you have to limit your media exposure or you're gonna be overly bombarded with all of this negativity. You're gonna have to take in what's helpful, what's realistic, what's real. But when you're personally triggered, when you feel that fearful about something, where do you feel that in your body? So I think it's an opportunity to take a look and see how your personal, your house, your car, your body are the vehicles through which you go through life. I'm working on a very interesting case with somebody who's working with a house issue, a kind of hoarding, sort of collecting. And I think we found the core memories about that, and we're working through that. And flipping it, we're flipping it actually into a positive. Like, okay, let's start with the small project where you have control and not overwhelmed by the whole house that's now been created. Let's start with that part of your, we don't do all the memories at once. We don't do all rooms of our house at once. We do a room at a time. We do a part at a time. We do the metaphors. And she's working through it. But I think it's an opportunity for some people. Now, if some are already overwhelmed by what's already happened, I agree. I would not do trauma work with them if they're already flooded and overwhelmed. But if you can find out what the current triggers are and give them safety, breathe colors, always breathe colors, breathe the color through your body, go to your safe scene, create safety for yourself, you know, that will help. So it's really about how are you personally handling. How are you letting the data in? Are you bombarding yourself? Are you overwhelmed? Now, if you feel like people are not listening to you, not hearing you, not respecting your boundaries, when you feel that, where do you feel that in your body? You could work with it. So I don't know, Colleen, if that helps somewhat about with that particular client. But I think the other way around, I think you have to feel it out. For some people that have already reached saturation before they get to you, like they're already overwhelmed. If some are like, look, I'm trying to manage this. So I asked, the COVID-19 email that I sent out, are you meditating daily? I've done yoga every day since March 22nd. I've never had the privilege and opportunity to have enough time on my hands to do yoga every day. And I'm doing yoga, 1,000 crunches a day. That's another whole story. But anyway, doing yoga, exercising, and now I've added my treadmill every day, my outside treadmill. So I have my own little workout house, you know, routine. So diet, you get to control your diet. There's never been a better time for water fasting. If you want to do a little fasting time, you have complete control over your environment without interruption. If you want to do a little water fasting, things of that sort. So what do you want to look at as the blessings, as the opportunity to turn this into a positive situation? You know, you do have to increase your self-care. I don't know, this may go on for, the immunity issue will probably go on for about 2 years. That we're going to have to build global immunity, come up with a vaccine. Vaccine will have to spread. People will have to find that they're now not able to get the virus, that they're feeling better. It's going to take a while. The vaccines will probably come out faster than we'd like. Although some viruses, they don't ever find the right vaccine. So, but they're finding things that are helpful for that. So I don't know if that answered your question, Colleen, in part. I think you kind of have to feel the clients out. But I don't agree. I think there might be some clients you can't do the trauma work with, and others are being so triggered that their prehistory of trauma is amplifying everything that's going on currently. If you heal a person's childhood trauma, their adolescent, their young adulthood trauma, all you're left dealing with is COVID-19 in 2020. And dealing with it right now as it is for us doing what you're doing is probably effective and manageable for now. But if it's bringing up all this anxiety and fear and, you know, like, who do I trust? Who do I listen to? Who's going to give me the right advice? You know, is my health at risk? Oh my God, I'm going to die. A lot of people's fear is just hugely escalated at this point. And I think at least 50% of the standard population's fear that's triggered is not about COVID-19. It's not about present time. I'll bet, I'm being conservative, minimally 50% of that you could work on is past memory.
Yeah,
illnesses,
yeah, as soon as you said unseen and unheard, that really helped me kind of lock it in for her, because that is one of her really, really big things. So that gave me a chance to, a way that we can work on it. So, yeah, thank you.
Sure, you're welcome. I see childhood patterns. I've done this so long that by the time I take the history, anytime they talk, I'm referencing their childhood history. When they start talking about it, like, oh, you remember this house. And I'll say, anytime you see a pattern three times, you came into this lifetime to heal it. It's an opportunity for clearing, healing of the pattern. Yeah, my father was a narcissist. My first boyfriend was a narcissist. My first husband was a narcissist. Like, wow, look at that. You're here to not end up with a narcissist in this lifetime. How exciting is that? Like, yeah, well, my boss is a narcissist right now. Like, okay, maybe we need to look at that one too. That's another whole discussion, work environment trauma, because now people are freaking out. Like, now they're having to go back to work, even if they don't go back to work, and under the circumstances, they might lose their job. So we have a lot of work too. I think I have job security for another few years, probably, you know, as a trauma therapist. So you probably are training in a good field right now, because time in our evolution. We need resources that can be shared, readily shared, and create safety. So you were listening, you know, so keep doing the work you're doing. Some of you have been reviewing cases with me personally, and that's great stuff. I mean, you're doing amazing work. Keep doing what you're doing. Anytime we heal memories, and remind the client, anytime you heal any kind of memories, be they small or large, you're boosting the immune system. And, you know, T cells replicate slowly, but over a year's time. But if you do multiple memories in a short amount of time, your probability, your T cells are going to surge, is much, much higher. Much more likely. You'll be more immune to viruses and things of that sort. Okay. Other questions, so, cases?
Uh-huh. Yes. Brent, what's going to happen to the certification process if you're not coming up or we cannot fly?
I'm not traveling so much. You know, what I'm going to do with the, I do have a healing intensive coming up at the end of June. We're on schedule for that still. In fact, I think 8 people signed up or something. I don't know if we'll get the whole 8 coming back, but, you know, Arizona's been, you know, we have a million people in Tucson. We have in the county here with the city, we have 1,700 documented cases of COVID, you know, but people are exercising a lot of precautions, and Trader Joe's, which is not far from the hotel we use, is exercising the 6-foot only, letting so many people. They've been great. They've been great about that. I've been grocery shopping a couple of times, and things seem to be fine. Social distancing will still be in place. But in the healing intensive, we can spread out. We have a huge room. We can spread out and be comfortable with that. I will work with you, and I probably, you know, I have a hunch that I already had the virus in December and January. I'm trying to look for the antibody test. So I think I probably already had it. Glenda, you may be surprised by that discussion, but I asked my guides when I got it, I said, because I'm going to be traveling, I thought I had allergies or the flu, because it was a dry cough, so.
You did scare me, you know, that's why I kept my mask on a lot Christmas.
I hear you, and I don't think you got anything, right, to my knowledge?
No, I did not.
See, I wasn't going to travel because I said, if I'm getting the flu, because I was exposed on the 21st, and Glenda and Carl and I, we were traveling on the 23rd. And I'm like, well, if I'm getting the flu, Glenda has a respiratory thing. I don't want to travel with that. But I said, it's a dry cough. It's not the usual flu that I ever had. Well, didn't I? Little did I know. So I don't know if I've had it or not, quite honestly, but I still have pain below my sternum, which some of you shared with me. You know, when you're recovering, you still have pain below your sternum when you're coughing. So the next step would be a CAT scan looking for, what do they call it, crushed glass opacity, that in the areoli and the top of the lungs, if they've been damaged by a virus or something, it's going to show up in a CAT scan. My x-ray was clear. I did a chest x-ray. I'm clear. There's no pneumonia or anything there. And to my knowledge, when I went back to work the days after, nobody got the virus from me. My niece thinks she's had it and thinks the same thing. Nobody in her family got it. But in our history, we do have a thing for killing off viruses in our immune systems, that we do wipe it out pretty quickly. So there is a possibility that it got wiped out. But I couldn't smell or taste anything for 2 months, pretty much. And that's one of the indicators. So,
well, I've had in the past just normal viruses in the winter that they don't disappear. They come and go all winter long. Uh-huh. You know, uh-huh. Like arthritis in my hands and stuff like that. And I know it's just the virus that's been in my system all winter long. So,
who knows? But I'm kind of curious. I've signed up for I'm trying to get into an NIH study for blood serum studies for antibodies. Because I would be quite curious, because my niece said the same thing. She was very sick for 5 days, but her family around her didn't get it. Same thing.
Her family what?
Her family did not get it. They did not get the virus from her. And so there's, I mean, I can kill HPV-1 and HSV-1 by touch. I know that. I've always done warts, fever, blisters, papilloma. But I've never tested it on something like this. So that's why I'm curious to see if, even with exposure, if the antibodies are strong or something of that sort. So I'm curious. But it may be too late after having had it, whatever I had. But either way, I was happy. Glenda didn't get sick. Nobody got ill. We went through the holidays. And I self-quarantined for 2 weeks because I was off for New Year's. So maybe I didn't go back to work.
Maybe you can get tested to see if you have antibodies.
That's the discussion right now. There were 13, 17 different antibody tests. The ones that are available, only three of them might show up, late stage antibodies. The others say if it's been more than 6 weeks or whatever, there's a good chance it'll show negative because you've already overcome the virus. It's not there anymore. So I don't know what they're going to try to measure. They need a better antibody study, but I'm curious about that. I would like to know if I did have it then, because I've never had a coughing. But I didn't have much of the fever that I recall. The coughing was hideous and dry and very weird, and I was wheezing at one point. But it never impaired overall breathing, to my knowledge, and it didn't go up into my head very much. Mm-hmm. It did block nasal and hearing and smell and some things. But and I know the date, the advantage is I know the date of exposure. It was December 21st. And I didn't know, I wasn't sure I had anything. So I was like, I didn't go on vacation. So I talked to my guides, Glenda. I said, if we go on vacation, I don't want Glenda or anybody around me getting it. So if it's there, shut it down.
Well, it worked.
To my knowledge, we were good. So they protected you, Glenda. I talked to them. Because I wasn't sure. I was like, I had the flu shot this year, too. I had the flu shot, flu vaccine. So I was like, I'm not supposed to even be getting a bad version of anything like that. So,
I get the flu a lot, even though I get the flu shot. But
yeah. Anyway, so we don't know, folks. I'll keep you posted, let you know. So maybe if I have antibodies, I'll share my plasma with you. So we'll see what happens there. See where we go with all that. So, Brent,
if we cannot travel, I've done level 3 and I've done it online too. I passed. Now, how am I going to? So I'm going to send you all the paper.
Whenever you get all your documentation done, you can send it in. If I need to do, you can do HMR on me, long distance kind of thing, you know. We can always do a test that way if we have
to. That's what I was asking because, I'm at the end of
at the end of the road. We want to get you certified this year. It'd be a good time to get people certified. And, well, you've worked enough complex cases and asked enough questions and done enough
super. I use it every day, even through the phone.
Yeah, I'm not worried about you. As far as that goes. If I'm familiar with your work and how you're doing it, then that's easier for me to just pass the test and do it. But get the documentation, document your memories, get that done, and we'll go from there.
Okay.
Eventually, my goal is, should I do succumb to some illness and actually transition from this world as I plan to do someday, I want to have recorded enough healing intensives that there are 1,000 HMR demos available in the library online. And you can go back and review, how do you deal with nightmares? How do you deal with addictions? How do you deal with chronic pain? How do you deal with whatever? you know, viruses, you know, I want enough cases in the library that when I depart, that is recorded and is available for people to review. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, I'm going to depend on all of you to demonstrate it to other people and how it works. But it is effective. It's pretty exciting about how the things it is proving to be effective. And I get comments from therapists that do a lot of trauma work all the time about how it's worked with their patients. And I'm excited to see how you all are adapting it to these cases. Every person is different. Every person will be a little bit different, but the resistances and where they come from, some sessions will be easier, some sessions will be more difficult. Those that are medicated, like I said, it's interesting you brought up Paxil. That hasn't shown up in years. But Paxil, marijuana, alcohol, they do repress alpha. Marijuana, alcohol and pot repress alpha theta, which is HMR induces alpha theta. So if you're drinking at the same time you're smoking pot, trying to do HMR, you got a problem. The benzodiazepines drop the brain waves so low it creates an issue for many people. But a little bit of it can perhaps still, HMR can still be effective with a lower dosage. So it really depends. You're going to have to adapt and work with the clients that you have. Okay?
Yeah.
Any other questions, anyone?
Brent?
Yes, Michael?
Brent?
Oh, I'm sorry.
This is David Ebel.
Yes, Dave,
and,
sure.
I just wanted to comment that the insomnia work works wonderfully.
Oh, good.
Beautifully. And then the other thing I wanted to ask is I'm working with two young children, a 4-year-old and a 7-year-old. They were abducted 2 years ago for sex trafficking. The 4-year-old is nonverbal. And so I was wondering how you would best work with nonverbal children.
Actually, that's been my limitation. Is that HMR at this point is somewhat dependent on that they're, you could do it through art. That's where the art therapist comes in. You might want to refer him to an art therapist where he could draw a picture of a bad thing that happened to him. Now you could do this with him. You can have him like, can you draw a picture for me of anything that, how you feel today? And it'll go to reds and blacks for the really bad feelings. And then say, if we could change that to how you'd like to feel today, can you see what colors would you like? What would you like this picture to be? Or if he knows of the event and what happened to him. I did it on a 3.5-year-old leukemia patient who is very articulate and did it perfectly. Now he did a lot of color placement. Oh, it's like a soccer ball in my chest. It's tight, it hurts. What would you like to do with that? Kick it into the backyard. Take all the time you need to do that. Now I did ask, how old are you? I don't know what that's about. What would you like to do with the soccer ball? Kick it into the backyard. So the kids do a lot of color replacement. If you tell them we're just going to play with colors, sometimes you can call it that and color play, and it works really well because it's a whole different level. It's a whole different language. So drop down to their level, do color play. They can draw pictures. So in art therapy, we've had little girls who watch their brother get shot, go to crayons and draw this black red picture with monkey faces leering, holding the black gun. So now let's change that picture, make it nice. What colors do you see? And I tried to present this to the American Academy of Art Therapists, and they got like a lockdown. They're insecure because they're not psychologists and think they're second-class citizens. So they will only let art therapists present at their conferences because they're like, we're very special. Anyway, got into a whole politics thing. So anyway, they don't know about this yet. But I trained a few art therapists. So you can work with children with colors, crayons, get pictures out. Draw a picture of it. Can you draw a picture of the bad thing? How do you feel today? Now, if you could change that, how would you like to feel? What would be different? Can you see what colors would make you happy? Then what I would do is have them close their eyes and try to breathe the color. Or do like, what would you like, a waterfall? Can you picture a waterfall of blue-green or going through your whole body? So you can always work with children using color. They're very good with color. They're really brilliant.
Very good.
Now, the 7-year-old, yeah. They tried to bring me a 9-year-old girl who was a Khmer Rouge child who witnessed her parents' murder, but they don't know if she remembered it, saw it. They tried to bring her, and she was shy and nonverbal, and she wouldn't talk. So I try to make it very, you know, oh, we're going to play with colors, and, you know, we're going to do. I worked with a 14-year-old. I told you about her in past sessions, but a 14-year-old who was, like, there because I was the 8th therapist her mother referred her to, and she was staring at her newly painted nails and wasn't going to talk to me. And then I was like, you don't really want to be here, do you? She's like, no. I was like, why is that? Well, you're the eighth therapist they've referred me to. I said, well, let me tell you about this, because I'm not doing therapy on you this time. I said, this is about if you want to release something painful from your body. And then when it came down to it, and I know, Dave, I don't know if you haven't had a chance to practice the energy thing too much, but I finally said, you know, my mother told me a little bit about what was going on. And so the 14-year-old, I just put my children, the younger they are, if you can do the energy part, the faster they respond. They are so fast. So the unfortunate part with COVID-19, I guess you're seeing them in person? Or?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, seeing them in person.
So if you can, you know, I place my hand on C7. And when I do that, teenagers, children, you'll see their eyelids start to flicker. You'll see them go into active alpha theta. And the younger they are, the faster and the quicker the access. They go into really fast visual access. And you get to say, is there a color you're seeing you want to move through your body? What color would you like to move through your body to feel better? I teach them to breathe color. So that's probably one of the things you can do for anxiety or tension is breathe color. And I think the 4-year-old is probably too young to be working on some of this stuff, but if you could teach them to breathe, basic skills to calm themselves down, to breathe color, I don't know what the behaviors are. If the 7-year-old is articulate and has the memories, he could do it and probably do it fairly quickly. You could even have him draw pictures of some things and then change the picture to make it safe. And then if you have them move the Brent, colors of the correction through the body, it'll help.
Brent, I've had a couple of mothers that have young kids. One was 2 or 3 and was terrified of a dog. And another mother, the kid had experienced domestic violence. And so I asked each mother at home the next time the kid was disturbed to have the mother put her hand on C7 and to calm the kid down. And when the kid became calm, to ask him, what color do you need right now? And the kids knew their colors, and they brought the colors in their body. And after the mother used it a few more times, and eventually the kid could tell the mother what color he needed at that time when he didn't feel good. And I think letting the mother, who's already got a trust relationship, put her hand on C7. Instead of us, I'm not sure whether that's what you were saying. You might have been been saying that. You might not, but the mother already or should have that bond, that secure bond or partial secure bond, and it seems to be very, very quick when the mother just adds that emotional support to C7 and then asks the kid what color. And it happens very, very quickly. And one particular kid who was really terrified of dogs, very quickly, within once or twice of that happening, the whole thing was gone. And so she uses it now whenever the kid starts to get any kind of stress, or the kid will run to her when he's feeling stress, and she puts her hand on C7, which enhances the trust and the bond and everything else. And so the child is independently learning how to use the color on themselves, which is much, much better than us having to facilitate it. Right. And so the child is independently becoming empowered, and you know, at a very young age, it's so natural and their brain is so simple that as you were saying, the color moves very quickly, releases very, very quickly, rather than an adult that has all the defenses and the complex patterns. So, it seems to work very, very natural with the C7. And then the other thing that with some parents, I just recommend to them to start off with play therapy, because kids can naturally play out their entangled conflicts. And usually if the play therapist is good, the kid will make quite a bit of progress just with play therapy. But I think that the C7 and the color is much quicker, much, much more powerful than anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good. Thanks, Scott. That's because you worked with kids, and I haven't had that much exposure to young children, but the therapists that I've worked with that do color therapy and art therapy find that that's helpful. So drawing pictures. But yeah, the mother thing is a great idea. I mean, that's how where C7 probably comes from, is the mother establishes safety, unless the mother's part of the trauma pattern. But in general, if you can have the mother put the hand on C7 and teach them to breathe. Sometimes grandma does it. I have a lot of grandmas teaching their kids to breathe and move color through their body to get them to go to sleep at night. That's for children having trouble sleeping. Have them create their safe scene. Now, I would say let's create a beautiful, safe place and see if you could talk to the 4-year-old and 7-year-old. Is there a place in nature you like to go to? You like the beach? You like the mountains? You like a forest? You like the park to go to the park? If they can create some little safe scene, what's your favorite color at the park? Can you pick a color for me and show me your color? Breathe that through your body. So they can do that. But like I said, if a mother can put her hand on C7, they'll go visual. At C7, kids go active and they see color. They just see the colors. They just start coming to them. And the little 3.5-year-old was the most amazing. He saw all the colors. Like the nurse said she wasn't going to hurt me. Then she jabbed me with that giant needle for his chemo for leukemia. So she lied to him and then stabbed him with the sword. So he's like, okay, I like that. We're not stabbing with a giant needle. Maybe take a pill. So he changed it. He was very articulate. He was like a 3.5-year-old going on 14 or 15 or something. He was amazing. And to my knowledge, he's cancer-free to this day. So he's done really well. So color. People use color. Even that I never got to work on them. They're like, I heard your lecture. I'm an artist. I know my colors. I breathe my colors through my body every day. I put my hand over my tumor site in my breast. I ran colors through it. When they went in to do the lumpectomy, there was nothing there. She said the doctor was freaked out, came back. And so I said, so she wrote me a letter and thanked me for something I never did, except the lecture. She said, I'm an artist. I know my colors. Thanks for suggesting that. I healed my tumor in my breast, and there's nothing to operate on. She said, but I thought I knew the memory, too. So when I ran the colors through, when they went to do the lumpectomy, there was nothing to operate on. And they even did a PET scan later to check, and there's nothing there. So we're very powerful with color. So I would say go to color for children. And like you said, have the mother do the color piece. Okay?
Great. I'll use both of those ideas. That's fantastic.
Sure, sure. Great.
Brent, can I make another comment about some of the questions about clients that were very disturbed and either not ready to do a trauma or couldn't quite do a trauma at that point because the trauma was too strong because their anxiety was too high?
Uh-huh. Yeah, you've done great with the breathing work with that too. So yes, please.
Yeah. So when a client has anxiety of a 7, 8, 9, 10, then they're not quite ready to process the trauma because what's on the surface, the number one symptom is anxiety. And so to deal with the anxiety directly, I always teach my client the breathing process first, in through the nose, out through the nose, which is relaxing for most clients, not all clients, about one out of 20, if they're too overloaded, they can't quite use that. It takes a lot more work. But most clients, once I teach them breathing, if they walk in and say, my anxiety is at an 8, I'm not processing traumas. I ask them to breathe. And in 5 minutes or at the most 10, I mean, usually in 5 minutes, their anxiety is down to a 4. Then I start processing the trauma. If the anxiety spikes up again, I stop the processing. We go back to breathing and we bring the 8 or 9 back down to a 3 or a 4, which is much more manageable. And so whenever anxiety is on the surface, that's the symptom. That's what the body's giving you. And so rather than try to bypass it and process traumas, I go with what the body gives me, which is it's giving me anxiety right now. So let's process anxiety, make it manageable, and then process the traumas much more smoothly than at a higher elevated, activated state of anxiety of 8, 9, 10, because there is about 1 out of 10 clients that will never come back if you're processing their traumas when the anxiety is 8, 9, 10, because they don't like the feeling of it. So it's much more conducive to my practice to never let them experience that anxiety at a high state for a long period of time, to bring it down so they always feel like they're in control.
Right. Yeah, good observation on that. And breathing color. That's the whole piece in this. Breathe color.
Yes.
I'm having everybody now add to their yoga practice all their respiratory breathing exercises and meditations. Add color while you're meditating, you're chanting. What color are you seeing? Breathe the color through your body. That's talking to your subconscious. So breathe in the colors. Keep breathing the colors through your body. I think actually we're doing a portion of that with every client. I say, picture your safe scene. Now take your time. I prefer to breathe the color, and you can do a waterfall if you like water. They may have, I work with whatever nature elemental image they want to use, but in many cases I say the easiest for me is breathing. So as I'm scanning and working with this, take the time you need to breathe that color through your body. So you're already doing breathing and color with every client. You're giving them the option at least to work with clients with breath and color every time you work. But I think what Scott is saying too is very accurate about that, particularly if they're really high levels of anxiety. You want to bring them down. I think for most of the time in the context I'm working with, he was working inpatient for a long time. A lot of the clients that come in with that, I don't see that at Miraval coming in with that level of anxiety usually. I haven't. And even in my private practice, not so much. But that is a clientele you work with a lot. So take that breathing to heart. We might have to have you, Scott, do a breathing class with us one day. That would be great to do just a breathing exercise, breathing training for all the therapists, or how you've adapted it for your clients. So think about getting a workshop set up about that. I'd be glad to coordinate anything through my corporation that we can do to get that going. But I think that would be a nice Zoom class to do about breathing during this COVID time or something. So think about that.
Okay. Are you still going to have that? You said next year, like in the spring, I think you were going to have a conference in Tucson.
Our retreat is moving to the Redemptorist Retreat Center here in Tucson for 2021 and 2022. So yes, we are doing that. And if people wanted to come for that and stay an extra day or something like that and do like a breathing therapy workshop, something like that, I'd be willing to support that for you too. They charge a little extra fee, whatever you want to charge for that or something like that. But particularly the therapists and the people that are our core group, they often do attend our retreat. It's limited to about 24, 25 people. But that would be an option.
Sure. Okay. Yeah.
There were some other questions. I'll keep entertaining questions. See, like you're getting warmed up good now. So Bill had a question and Michael had a question. Yes. Michael, you had a question first. I think you're raising your hand.
Yeah, it's just going back to the medication and self-medication and the benzoys. Wellbutrin, what does that fall in under?
I have not had any trouble with Wellbutrin to my knowledge. I wish Mary Gaddy was here. Hold on to that question. We need to get the neurologist online with this. Mary Gaddy often has feedback for us about Wellbutrin and the impact. Most of the SSRIs and antidepressants have not interfered with this work, to my knowledge. They don't affect visualization of the optic centers. Paxil was the exception on that, and I'm not sure what classification Paxil is exactly. But it definitely was able to interfere. So think drugs that do, let's say, as a side effect, affect visualization or optic nerves could be impactful to this. But benzodiazepines are the real forces that are inimical because they make you look like you're doing HMR correctly, but it locks out the access to T-1. So the memory will come back right up next week as though the charge is untouched. Yeah. So Xanax, Clonopin, Valium, and Ativan is that group of drugs that mess with memory access. And they call them anti-anxiety drugs, but we know that they're memory repressants. The doctors or the psychologists or whoever suspected trauma in your history and they're giving you an anti-anxiety drug. Well, yeah, it calms you down because it's repressing the effect of your trauma history. It's repressing your memories. It drops the brainwave hertz down to 40, 50 hertz. I told the neurologist about my theory. He says, oh, that's not a theory anymore. We've measured it. It is dropping the brainwaves down so low they you can't reprogram. If they're on benzos, we have trouble with the neurofeedback. We can't do the neurofeedback with the benzo influence. minutes. It's the brain waves are too slowed down. He says, so you're not able to re-imprint. We're not able to re-imprint. We're not able to do that with the benzo impact. You know, it's inhibiting re-imprinting access. And I had a client who did reframing, stopped her seizures, was doing great, and had a crisis in her family. The doctor put her on a benzo and her seizures came back. Memory based. Like, what the heck? This is crazy. So whatever we did with HMR can perhaps be undone with a repressant benzo that represses the memory of the HMR. So isn't that a crazy outcome here to look at? So there. So yes, any other question about that, Michael? That was your question. Okay. Mr. Bill, you had a question?
Yeah, pretty quick question. I may have asked this before, but if I did, I forgot what your answer was. Yeah, especially since maybe a lot of us are doing more sessions over the phone and video and that type of thing. So if I'm working with, let's say, a couple and doing HMR with one person, how beneficial would it be for their partner to lay their hand on the C7 while I'm doing the work?
For the partner to do that part, anybody, you know, you can have that. It's kind of nice. I encourage couples actually to do HMR with each other. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, so you feel angry about that. If they know, particularly they know if it's not about each other, like they can facilitate that with each other. It's very nice for couples to learn HMR to do with each other. So put your hand on, especially they know if their partner, wife had a childhood, their husband had a terrible traumatic childhood and they're working through their memories. I'm like, oh, well, this is good to know. You can have your partner sit in while we do this work if they want to observe. At Miraval, a lot of people want to sit in with their best friend or sit in with their partner and watch what they're doing. And if the partner's okay with it, I'm fine with that. Let them observe. Let them learn how to do it. Because if they get triggered again, like, okay, ask, you want me to put my hand on your C7? Like, yeah, I'm having a little trouble reframing it by myself. You can put your hand there and it helps. They feel grounded. They feel safe. They're more able to access visual memory more easily with a hand on C7. So yes, if the partner can do that, that's kind of cool, actually. I think every couple should be learning how to do this with each other, myself, but we're not quite that far in our educational process yet. But yeah, so certainly they can.
So, but I'm saying if I'm the practitioner and they've got their partner who's witnessing the process, would it be probably, I would think it'd be more helpful if their partner, if somebody there was holding their C7.
Well, you know, it depends. You have skills, and most therapists I'm training are fairly empathic, maybe highly empathic. I can't say that about their spouse. Now, if the spouse is a narcissist, you are not to have them put their hand on the client in the chair. You know, that's not going to work that way. So you want to make sure that the person that's open to that is fairly emotionally available and is going to ground and anchor the person and not create a situation, I guess. You want to make sure about that. But we run energy into C7 because it enhances sensory and data access to memory. It's doubled or tripled. It increases visual sensory access to memory, induces alpha theta. So it depends on the health and well-being of the partner as to how much they're going to transmit. Now, those of you that I'm training that do regular meditation and do your own disciplines and your self-care, you're transmitting a pretty high frequency. My first option would be let them observe and have you do it. If they want to do it at home and help the client, if you're not around, you're not available, then let the partner facilitate at C7. If the person feels extreme safety because of their partner, that might be a reason to do it. But I wouldn't want their safety to become dependent on the partner either. As a therapist, you're trying to teach them to be autonomous, independent with their safety, whether the partner is alive, dead, present, not present. You want to have the client learn to create safety on their own. So, you know, you can teach it to them, you can facilitate it. HMR, putting a hand on C7, enhances the data, so they're learning it faster, they're feeling it more intensely, they see how the colors move, they're able to map through the body faster. They're seeing it initiates that self-mapping sequence. So the metaphors will start jumping around. I call it the pinball effect. The body initiates a self-mapping sequence and it starts moving and showing you the memories you're supposed to work on. And that's why the software was developed, to map the complexity of those sequences, because often it gives you the history of a disease or an illness or a pathology or a depression or anxiety or whatever. So it actually is initiating almost a kind of a medical process, certainly a neurological mapping process. So it's nice to have the idea of the person doing that with them. I like the data that comes through my hand. Personally, I wouldn't give it up. If the partner was there, I would be disinclined to have the partner put their hand there. I want the data. I want to know when it's releasing. I want to feel them heat up. I want to know that they're releasing tingling. I want to know the pain has left the body when they did it. I like the feedback information that I get from the link. So, but that's kind of, it's up to you. If you're not, you know, not doing it that much or not that sensitive or not, you know, but I think you can learn to feel this. You know, I'm like, oh, wow, you're heating up. Oh, I'm getting really hot. I'll minimize it. Like, are you heating up a little bit? Oh, I'm about to burst into flames here. I was like, okay, well, good. You're releasing. You release that memory. You have better energy flow in your meridians. That's why you're heating up. And I'll talk to them about it because I feel it as they feel it. I mean, if you have doubts about whether empathy is real or not, they should videotape a couple of us doing this technique. Because whether you're empathic or not, you become empathically linked with the client when you do the technique. And so you have information and data that comes to you. If you're already an empath, prepare yourselves. I have no idea where this is going. You know, 10 years ago, I wouldn't have told you that I could scan the front of the body or holographically scan anything and pick up data correctly. The first client I scanned when we went, you know, my practice is 99% face-to-face. The day that, the week that flipped and I scanned the first client, there were two concussion sites. And the minute I scanned both of those long distance, I was nauseated at both sites. Said, have you had two concussions? Yeah, I have actually. Let's work on those first. And we did it. So I think we're going to, as a species, this is going to force us to evolve and do therapy a little bit long distance. It doesn't mean it has to be less effective. I think we can still practice it very well. A lot of people feel very sad. I noticed that years ago. People feel very safe when they're in control of the phone. If they don't like you, they can hang up. You know, the truth is they're in control of the relationship and the transaction. If you're getting on their nerves, they're like, oh, there's a phone problem here. I can't hear your voice. You know, they could get rid of you here, you know. So I think people have a weird safety when it comes to telephones. It might be that we trance, it's possible that we have telephone trancing. That when we get on the phone, we go into autopilot. And it's like when you're eating, they find the most suggestible times are when you're eating, I think taking a shower. That's when Silva Mind Control, they tell you to try to transmit information when you're eating to someone or when they're showering or something like that, or doing some driving, an automatic process. We all know driver hypnosis. You start spacing out while you're driving and you just left the car, you know, kind of thing. But I think that maybe being on the telephone is also a kind of, for many people, sort of an innate trancing mechanism. So it's possible that we have a trance advantage doing phone sessions. I'm not sure about that yet.
I think Zoom contributes to that as well, because I've been working on Zoom for quite a while with clients, both half and half. And I think there's a level of peering in and focusing down in that helps to support a trance.
That works. Yeah. Cool. Glad feedback. Yeah, it's good. Thank you for sharing that.
I have a question.
I'm just starting to work with Zoom. Yes, question. Sure, Julie.
But I also noticed that I can't do as much Zoom either. Oh. That's a piece that I'm noticing after the last few months, because as I said, my clients have been in person and on Zoom, and with them all on Zoom, I just can't do as much.
Can't do as much.
No.
That's interesting.
But I am experiencing the same thing you are, and have been for years. Is you could still do an empathetic, you could still do a scan kind of on the body.
Yeah,
it's not a challenge. It's almost sometimes easier in a sense. I don't know why, but
well, that's true. It's because you can actually shrink the body so that it's more manageable in the scan. Right? You can shrink the size of their energy field and actually scan them more specifically. You can even picture going to the lower body or legs or whatever, and you know, it works. It works fine.
Well, and one of my tools is that in my mind, I sometimes create a screen, you know, that I'm working on. So it works. But I do have a question around self-administered C7 to help calm clients. I know that I've been experimenting a little bit with it. And one of the things, I have one of those fabulous hard balls that you can put on your back.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, you know, got the little cranial sacral ball that you can put back.
Exactly. Yeah, so, and that's amazing, right? That is amazing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the dog and the cat don't have thumbs, so it's solo over here. So what I'm finding, though, is that sometimes if I'm using intention and I'm working with myself, I can actually get that ball in the right place. And with the breath work that the other gentleman was talking about as well too, you know, literally do some of that work for myself. But I'm kind of wondering if anyone has any experience, and Brent, if you have any experience with helping folks do that for themselves when we're actually working with them.
Yeah, that's a good question about doing it on yourself that way. I think whatever puts you into an alpha theta state is doing kind of the same thing. So the real question is, what techniques are out there that do alpha theta? Now, Antoinette and some of us that have done retreats for years know that a guy named, I wish he had done the whole set, but Harold Moses generated something he called a perfect harmonic fractal fifth, the interval. The interval, the fifth intervals in, you know, the C to C, whatever.
Right.
And those intervals are sacred in Egyptian culture and music and history. Anyway, the fifth is very sacred. So he generated the one for the heart and the throat. Is that right, Antoinette? The heart and throat chakras. He did two drones. He called it the drone. And did one for the heart, and I think he did one for the throat. When I listen to the one for the throat, it's just a sound in the background. But it activated my whole throat chakra, and I went through 8 memories and reframed them on my own. 8 metaphors. Some of them were memories. I got the memory. Sometimes it was just an object I threw out. But it was so clear that I could trust it and throw it out. So here's the thing. If you can surround the chakra with perfect frequency, like the perfect harmonic frequency around that chakra, the day may come when we have therapeutic rooms. They're like, I got a pain in my throat. I need to hit the throat chakra button. And the room and the colors and everything will sound. So you probably would have been frank about this. You know, will sound and create the sound and the frequencies that create optimal energy around the throat. And then all that's left in the room is you with your little traumas in your throat that are now going to go active, and you'll be able to feel them because they are not at a healthy throat frequency. They are not proper. So when I brought it to white light and put this harmonic fractal fifth sound around my throat, I'm like, whoa, there's a lump over here. Oh, now it's over here. It's a little needle. Oh, now it's up here. It's like a little knot. Now I moved to the back. It's like a rubber band, like a tightness. And I went through 8 metaphors and threw them all out, and my throat was clear and everything went away. And I'm like, that was weird. So yes, I'm sure there's an unlimited number of ways we can enhance that without mm-hmm. having to turn. Now C7 turns on the whole light frequency in the body to induce alpha theta. Harold Moses did was he targeted the frequency, optimal frequency. So some people have the tuning forks for the chakras. That might work, but I'm not sure that everybody's chakras are tuned absolutely identically. I doubt that myself, actually. I think we have a variation in our DNA evolution. But you can put the optimal frequency, so that at least for the throat and the heart, it was a lot easier to heal memories around those two areas when his fractal fifth sound was emanating. I was like, wow, it's like I'm in a perfect love white light field for that chakra. Mm-hmm. But it's not, if you turn it off, it's not maintained. So yes, there are other ways of doing that. As to C7, I don't know of anything or device that's actually produced an overall body C7-like effect as the human energy field linking with another energy field to create that current. But you might be able to do, I don't know, visualize a guide or somebody coming in and doing that.
Right.
You know, right. And have them hold the space, ask them to hold the space. Whenever I'm sick and I ask my guys to do something for me, they show up. They've always shown up. So I probably could try that.
I have had good fortune with that. And I think when I used the ball, it was with the intention that I was literally, it was my energy that I was putting in the ball and I was using, mm-hmm. you know, to work with myself. But that's wonderful. Thank you so much for sharing that. I
You're
appreciate
welcome.
It.
And it's nice to have a practice. That's why I love the practice groups when we're able to be face to face again someday to have the practice groups, because in the cities you're in, if you can, you all will be the pioneers that probably help to create trainees in your regions. After 2 years of certification, you can be a supervisor or whatever and work on clients continuously. Some of you already do it faster than that. But I need people that are trained in this who can supervise others. But when you're there with a practice group, you can do it with each other too. So it kind of also works as keep the therapist clear. When you have a little support practice group that's local, it's nice when we can do that. Karen, you're part of a therapist small group that's doing kind of a yourself, I don't know what you want to call it. It's not supervision really. It's processing with each other cases and things, right? Yeah. So anyway, but you can develop local groups and there will be subgroups and things like that. It's nice to have the support of a practice group locally to do that, but we're not out there enough to have that available in most regions. Yeah.
I wanted to say something about the drone.
Uh-huh.
I have started, I put it on very, very low in the background in the bedroom, and it just plays 24/7 in that room. And it has actually helped me sleep better. And it's on a level that it's like below where I can't, you know, I don't really consciously hear it. It's kind of a very, very mm-hmm. low white noise in the background. But I love the feel of the room with that going 24/7.
Interesting. Okay. Well, the Om, they have the Om chant that can go 24 hours a day, chant, you know, whatever you can do to raise the vibration of that space is really good at this time. So meditate, eat right, take better care, take good care of yourselves. Okay. Any other questions, comments? You're all looking good. I'm glad you're all healthy and well. Keep up the good work. We'll survive all this and move on. Your work is needed. You know, we need the trauma piece. A lot of people are losing a lot of family members, and there's going to be trauma after this. When people are coming out of it, it's going to be a rush. So we'll see what happens with that. So you're listening and keep up the good work. Share your cases. If we need to do something more, talk to me. If we need to do an extra, you know, supervision session sooner or something during the midst of all this, or use the opportunity to do that, we can always set that up for another Wednesday and process, because I think it's important that we stay focused on what we're doing and keep the training going. But like I said, I just announced that I was available for phone sessions, and as of today or tomorrow, I think I've done 99 phone sessions since I announced availability. So it's a little crazy, but it's really good. I enjoy it. And especially people that are following up every week and doing regular work, I get to, with the software, I get to see the sequencing and the mapping, the patterns and the memories. So anyway, keep doing what you're doing. Thank you for all your healing work, and bring your questions. Thank you, Jeanette, too. Any questions, Jeanette, or anything you want to say?
No, Karen, stay on the line so I can help you with your online training thing. I got your solution.
Okay. All right. Anybody need me to hang out for anything? Any other questions? We're all good. All right. Take care, everyone. Bye. Ciao.
Bye. Thank you, everyone.
Thanks. Oh, and Erica, if you still want to do a session, a personal session, we can still do that sometime.
Yeah. I like to.
Just call me. We can set that up. You want me to call you? Do you have a preference?
Either way, it's fine. Yeah.
Okay, good. Yeah, we have some time this week. Things are kind of calming down a little bit. Bye, right. Mr. Bill. Bye. Yeah. Bye, everybody.
Bye, everybody.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Okay, Karen, the solution to your online thing is pretty easy. Go out and try to log on, and there's a little thing that says forgot password. Choose that, it'll send you an email and you can reset your password. What the support people told me, and I was none too happy about this because I'm an administrator to this software, they said you can't change somebody else's password. They have to change it themselves. I went, then why do I have the ability to do that in the screen? Well, we turned that off. I went, okay. So I'm sorry I haven't gotten to you and told you that earlier, but all you have to do is go try to log on and use the forgot password part. I'm going to unmute you so you can talk to me. Hang on.
Okay, am I unmuted?
Yep, I can hear you now.
Okay, yeah, I was just talking away.
I could see that.
Okay, I would do that, and I hadn't been anxious to do it. I've been busy. So that's good. But let me ask you something else.
Uh-huh.
What, I don't know how to ask even. I'm working with Bessel van der Kolk, not directly, but, and just feel burdened to get our software analyzed so we can tell him Brent Baum has 150,000 memories from 20,000 clients. And it's this many men and this many women, and this many
years
with this. How big a deal is that?
That's not a big deal. If you want some stats, what do this for me. Send me an email with the stats you want, like number of men, number of women, age groups, whatever, number of cases. I mean, there's a wealth of information I can pull from the database and give you some stats.
Well, look at this. I sent Brent a very long email. I can send you the email. And it basically, I went through and analyzed, like, there's 630 colors available. There are 490 somatic locations.
Right.
And my thought, like on somatic location, I think somebody like Bessel, I'm just using him as an example.
Yeah.
Let me tell you a little brief background. Gigi Dunn, have you met Gigi? I don't think you've met her.
I don't believe I have.
She's an anesthesiologist from Baton Rouge who has retired because she's disenchanted with Western medicine, and she does integrative medicine. She got a degree with Andrew Weil as well, okay?
Ooh.
And she, Brent gave her training for free, and I attended training with her, and she's been sending me tons of clients because she knows Western medicine is failing.
Mm-hmm.
And her position, she has worked with Bessel van der Kolk before. And her position is, we don't want to do the research. We want to entice him to do the research. Because if he does the research, it'll be done and approved internationally and accepted and all that kind of stuff. Okay.
You want to entice Bessel van der, whatever, to do the research.
Right.
Okay.
And so my thought, that's where she and I are kind of functioning right now. And I've sent Brent emails about that. And so my thought is, one way to entice him is with the research we've done. Another mm-hmm. way to entice him is by analyzing and giving him a summary of what this software has shown. It's too much valuable work for us not to be getting some benefit from it, is my position. Okay.
Okay. So I can tell you how we can do this. All right. Take one conclusion that you want to tell him about. We'll work one conclusion at a time.
Okay.
All right. So, you know, and it could be something you've observed, that metaphors that deal with sexual whatever tend to be, you know, something like that, you know, just a conclusion that you want to, then what I will do is go pull the information from the database.
Okay.
All right. And we put that up against some statistics that says, okay, on that statement, 40% of the time, it's true, or 50, 60% of the time, it's true. And we know it's true because of this metaphor and those colors and the solution that they pick. Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely. I'm excited.
Okay. And then we also say that, okay, 30% of the time, the evidence does not show that their solution is related to this. We try to find out statistically how many times a conclusion or a type of, and you can go to the, oh, my brain just went blank. It's not the solution, it's the T1 metaphor, you know, the actual,
yeah.
You know, so what we want to try to say is that when you have a T1 incident, a T1 uh-huh. event, this metaphor, here is what we find is the solutions, or we can go on both sides of the T1. Here is what the metaphors people use to describe it, all right?
Yeah.
And the other side is, here is the solutions that they come up with to resolve it.
Yeah.
All right. And so, and we can do as many of those as you want to, and I can send you that information. You can write it up and send it to him and say, we are able to quantify based on, and I can further break it down by, it's the amount of men that do it this way and women do it this way. I have no idea what this is going to show us. It could show some interesting, you know, things. Brent tends to talk in terms of, he knows this, and most of the time he does, because these are his clients,
yeah,
that he's working with. But yeah, what would be interesting is to pull that data out, and quantify it, you know, and say, okay, in fact, this is what we're seeing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, yeah, I think if we can take it from that data, why not take it from the database? We got the data.
Right, we've got the data. So what you do is go look at the T1 metaphors,
okay,
or whatever, and pick one or two that you want to work for this guy.
Yeah.
Send them to me, and what you think, or look at the all the different parameters that you fill in, and send me the what you think are the important parameters we want to draw information about. Is it male versus female, the age of the person, you know, what is the important information we want to try to quantify around this metaphor?
Right.
And then I will pull that data and give it back to you in statistics.
I love that. I love it. Because where I started was with, you know, a statistics class and I had in college, which
yeah. said,
okay, how many, for example, somatic location. He has 490 approximately in the software program.
Right.
And so my thought was for you to dump that and then the data that related to that and the 490 of them. And I'll have to sit and say, okay, this many of them are in the back. This many of them are in the leg because he uses so many different words to refer to back.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he says,
so, I mean, you can do that if you want to, if we want to do basically, because there's a lot of ways you can go at this. You can say, okay, let's find out statistical information about body mapping, where the metaphor is for these metaphor solutions, for these T1 metaphors.
Yeah.
All right. So basically what you want me to do is dump the T1 metaphors. You want me to dump the body mapping. Where was it on the body that that metaphor occurred?
And see, I'm thinking dump the color, because color
you can is dump the color too.
Color's the part that Bessel doesn't have.
Right. Okay.
And if we can say 2/3 of people have to use blue or green or, you know, whatever that is.
Right.
I think that's significant. But we, for him, he's so complex like Brent, we're going to have to tie those colors to something, you know, like to a T1, yeah. a T minus one or whatever.
Well, my theory is that the T1 metaphor is the one you should tie to.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, I think that's your starting point. And then you back into whatever data. And we can, like I said, we'll start with the simplest thing, the T1 metaphor. Where does it map on the body and what color was it when it mapped?
Well, I think that's so brilliant is what you've proposed, which is let's just start with one something and see what we get. And that'll tell us where we go from there.
Right. Pick. And actually, it's pretty easy to run these queries. You can pick 5 T1 metaphors, send them to me and say, okay, I want these parameters for these 5 T1 metaphors. I will pull it out, throw it into an Excel spreadsheet, and then we can, you know, sum it up and do some statistics, you know, against it.
Oh, I love it. You don't need the email I sent him, do you?
I'd love to see it.
Okay. I sent it and then I asked him, well, first of all, I said, I feel like we should do something with this data and we need to start analyzing it. And his response was, I'm game, let's go for it or something like that.
The problem is that once he's game, but he doesn't know how to do
it. Right. And so then I analyzed the software for hours and said, okay, we have 225 solutions for perpetrator, for example, you know, and 220 for T minus one emotion. And so I just listed how many of each one we had. And then I felt overwhelmed, but I sent a really long email. So the end of the email was, okay, what do we do now? I've analyzed this much. Do we talk
and
to
he was overwhelmed too.
He hadn't responded.
He's overwhelmed. I can tell you. Okay. So what has to happen is we have to start narrowing it down.
Yeah.
Like you say, go grab 5 T1 metaphors. Let's take a look at it because it, when it does overwhelm him like that, his brain, his thing is, oh, let's don't do it. you know, because, but if I break it down into nuggets, which is queries are easy to write.
Okay.
Show me this. And I get that information out. And then we put it into an Excel spreadsheet. then what happens is I can actually report out data, you know, and you can start saying, okay, for this metaphor, here are all the various places that it maps onto the body. Here's the color they map it, and here's the solution they use. What conclusions do we draw from that? You know, and it may not have a conclusion, but it's worth looking and seeing.
Right. And so we have 220 T-1 emotions. So what I'm going to do is look at those 220 and try to figure out how many of them mean the same thing to me and Bessel and a client. You know,
could do that. You could do that, or just pick five.
Okay. Okay.
Just pick five that you think are, pick five that you consider to be broad generals. You know what I mean? In other words, they're not really specific, unique, but they're more of a general, you know, I was overwhelmed. I thought I was going to die. Some of those broad ones, and let's see what the big data looks like. Okay. And then we can work down to the more discrete data.
Gotcha.
All right.
You gotcha. Okay. Well, I'm going to send you the email and I hope he'll understand. I'm not circumventing him, but we're just
bringing. No, he'll know that I can write the queries because he asked me to do it sometimes for him. Okay. Not that kind of stuff, but to find records for him. So he knows I can do that.
Well, I just feel strongly that it's time to start using this data to tell somebody something about what we've learned. I think we've learned a lot and we don't even know what it is.
I think you're going to be surprised. Now, I am going to tell you this on a personal note. In the middle of a pandemic, I decided to launch a nonprofit business.
Yeah.
Working with parvo dogs, which means I'm in the middle of the parvo season. So if I don't respond in a timely manner, you have my permission to bug me.
Okay.
Because I have days when I come in, lay down, sit down to watch TV, and I don't even see the first 15, after 15 minutes, I see nothing else. I just go completely to sleep. So bug me if I don't respond in a timely manner, okay?
Okay.
It's not that I've forgotten. It's that somebody else, something else may have, you know, caused me to put you to the back burner, and I need to be reminded not to do it.
All right. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And you've got Mary Gaddy and Bill White.
Yes, I sent those off to Beverly tonight.
Okay, wonderful, wonderful. That's the only thing I have pending, but you know how, you know me, I like to stir up every now and then, and when I'm healthy, I need to be stirring. So
obviously you're healthy now, huh?
I got energy, and we need to do something.
You know, I have been okay until last night. I woke up this morning. I told my husband, scared him half to death. Woke up this morning, 4:30 in the morning with diarrhea. I swear it's something I ate, you know. I feel better now, but I thought, oh, God, please, I cannot afford to get sick. You know, do not let me come down with anything in the middle of all this because I have tried so hard to make sure that I kept everybody else safe around me that's working in our center and all that kind of stuff. And I'm like, so I told everybody today, I need you guys to go in and do this because I'm not going to come near anybody until I know I'm feeling better.
I see some dark circles around the eyes. So you.
Oh, yeah. I don't feel well.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I can tell. You take care of you. And I thank you so much. And I just.
Send me that stuff. I'll pull it. Actually, running those queries doesn't take a lot. Analyzing the data may take a little bit. And that's where I'll get your help to analyze it.
Yeah, I'd love to.
Pulling it's not hard. Pulling it's pretty easy.
Super, super, super. Thank you.
All right.
I just
need your
email. Okay.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.